Good morning. And welcome. Thank you for making the journey. If you come from a long distance, yesterday was there was a big deluge, and traffic was pretty tough, and flooding was all over the place, and it was pretty exciting. This meeting is being webcasted and recorded, so all participants, please speak clearly. Members of the public who wish to observe or to address the board may join the meeting at the noticed physical location, or may use the Zoom application to address the board from a remote location. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available at www.cal-span.org. In addition, we're receiving presentations and public comment through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you should already be in the Zoom meeting room using the meeting ID and password you received from the clerk. If you've not already received the meeting ID and the password, you can go to our website at www.waterboards.ca.gov/North Coast. Click on the February 5 to 7 2025 board meeting button and follow the instructions to complete a virtual speaker card. You will then receive an email from the clerk with the Zoom login information. For anyone here in the meeting room that wishes to address the board, please complete a speaker card available on the tables outside the boardroom and give it to the clerk. For those in the Zoom meeting, your camera will be turned off and you will be on mute until it is your turn to speak. The clerk will unmute you when it is your turn to address the board. We will call each commenter by name and then unmute each commenter. I would also like to ask those who have provided a contact name to please state your name for the record before you speak. There is a normal 5-minute limit for each commenter. During public testimony, you will see a timer on the screen. For those calling in by phone, we will run the timer to let you know when you have 30 seconds left and when your time is up. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are called upon during public comment. When you are done speaking and the board members have completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of your item, and then you may choose to exit the meeting or continue. And if everyone would please check your phones and put them on mute. We will now move to the Pledge of Allegiance. We'll move on to roll call from my left.
Brian Sundberg from Northern Humboldt and McKinleyville, California. Thanks.
Greg Giusti, Ukiah.
Hector Bedoya, Northern Sonoma County, Healdsburg.
Sorry. Alex Hart, Siskiyou County.
Jake McKenzie, Roanoke Park.
Valerie.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and board members. Valerie Quinto, Executive Officer. To my far left is Bailey Toff Dupuy and Nathan Jacobson, counsel to the board. To my right is Josh Curtis, Assistant Executive Officer. Across from me is Claudia Villacorta, our other Assistant Executive Officer, and Deidre Wilkerson, our Executive Assistant, and other staff will introduce themselves as their items come up. Thank you.
Thank you. Board members, would you like to report anything, any communications, correspondence, anything of interest? Yes, Jake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm in receipt of a letter from the Senate Rules Committee Dear Dr. McKenzie, as you know, the Senate confirmed your appointment as a member of the Water Quality Control Board North Coast Region on January 27th. Senator McGuire wishes me best wishes for success. So I just wanted to, I guess I'm now finally a properly confirmed member of this board and looking forward to working with you guys.
Good news.
And you should know that I've also been appointed by the City of Rohnert Park to serve as a trustee on the Marin-Sonoma Mosquito and Vector Control Board.
Fantastic.
So there you go.
Thank you.
Full disclosure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Greg?
I just want to share with the board, I've had three, possibly four conversations with lily bulb growers over the progress of the proposed order that's been in the works for some time, and discussions that led to further discussions with Valerie about appropriateness of meeting sites and appropriateness of maintaining a neutral tone to all of the discussions. So they're certainly, it's a small group, there's only three growers, but the broader community is involved, and they are certainly watching from afar what this board is doing.
Thank you, Greg. Anyone else? Okay, well, I really don't have much to report other than I'm enjoying life, fully retired now, and enjoying our grandchildren, 5 and 7 years old. So moving on to state board liaisons and executive officers report. Is Dee Dee available?
I am. Good morning, Chair, members of the board.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. I'm enjoying my grandchildren as well, the highlight of my life these days. I'll start off by giving some information about the role that we've had at the water boards with respect to the Los Angeles firestorm that they've unfortunately had to deal with in Southern California. Since January 7th, when the major wildfires ignited in Los Angeles, our Division of Drinking Water and Emergency Management Program staff, along with the Los Angeles Regional Board staff, has been participating in response and recovery efforts. The Division of Drinking Water has been providing technical support to impacted water systems and advising on drinking water notices and inspecting damages. The Emergency Management Program staff deployed staff to Cal OES Debris Removal Task Force, removing household debris, and then Cal OES Watershed Debris Flow Task Force to mitigate post-fire debris flow and contaminated runoff. State Board staff is also supporting interagency coordination and external communications. And both state and regional board staff have been volunteering to support recovery efforts and advise on best management practices to protect water quality during debris removal activities. I'm going through some notes here, just one moment. Okay, and then an update on our Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs. As of December 2024, the Office of Public Participation has transitioned to the newly formed Office of Public Engagement, Equity, and Tribal Affairs. This change reflects the expanded scope of our work and the need to ensure that these efforts are really elevated and clearly defined within our organization. In 2021, the board combined the Office of Public Affairs with the Office of Public Participation under the new Communications Office. And while this structure made sense at that time, recent developments such as new executive orders, legislative changes, and the board's racial equity and tribal efforts have expanded significantly the Office of Participation's role beyond what this configuration was originally intended to support. And so we've restructured things to elevate the office's importance and better align our operations with these developments. then moving on to some of the activities from January, on January 22nd, our board approved the municipal stormwater cost policy and a staff report. Municipal separate stormwater system permittees will be expected to track their permit implementation costs in specified categories and to report those costs on the cost data portal. The goal here is not to provide, you know, another onerous requirement, but actually for us to be able to increase our understanding across the water boards, state board and regional boards, on the costs associated with various MS4 permit elements and to assist with an economic analysis as objective as possible as permits are reissued. Policy is at the Office of Administrative Law for approval and should become effective on or about April 1st. And then in our efforts to sort of replicate what we've done on our drinking water needs assessment, we have an effort underway that I've talked about before, the wastewater needs assessment. The advisory group met on January 24th. The role here is to advise project development team on specific phase one tasks, such as wastewater data gathering and gaps, baseline assessment survey, and effective outreach methods, identifying at-risk definitions and other areas of expertise. Okay. An update here on making conservation a way of life, the water use efficiency package that we adopted last year. On January 6th, our staff posted a FAQ document on this new regulation that became effective on January 1st. The text is also available on Westlaw. Urban retail water suppliers are required to submit an annual urban water use objective report on January 1st of each year. And for reports due this year, 75% were submitted on time, and then a bit later after that deadline, an additional 2% came in. So it really seems that we're off to a good start on reporting, and all that extensive outreach and communication with public water systems looks like it's paying off. So really looking forward to an opportunity to review and analyze those reports. On February 11th, next week, our staff will be holding a remote public workshop to provide an overview of the 2026 California Integrated Report. Our staff, as well as regional board staff, will be available to answer questions after a brief staff presentation. In late January, we completed our last board workshop on the Bay Delta Plan update, the draft that's before us. And staff is now holding a series of very detailed technical work group meetings to receive further input from the stakeholders and tribes that have been engaged in this process. Really seeking specific input on the October 2024 draft that includes regulatory provisions based on our September 2023 draft staff report. That includes a regulatory component for unimpaired flow and also includes a package on the voluntary agreements that have been proposed by public water agencies, state and federal agencies, now known as the Healthy Rivers and Landscape Proposal. So we're really drilling in on the detail of those proposals, as well as what we call a backstop, which is the unimpaired flow proposal that was originally released by our staff. All of these work group meetings are open to the public, but you have to sign up to participate. And the information on how to do that is on the program webpage for the Bay Delta update. Our administrative hearings office continues its work on two high-profile permits that are before us. The Delta Conveyance Project, that hearing begins on February 18th with policy statements first up in the morning, and then opening of the procedural issues for a procedural portion of the hearing in the afternoon. More information is on the Delta Conveyance Project website under the Office of Administrative Hearings. And then that office is also resuming its work on and hearing on Sites Reservoir. Those hearings resume, I don't have the exact date, resume this week, and I'm just not remembering when the next one is, but details, again, are on the Office of Administrative Hearings website for the Site Project Water Authority permit application. On February 20th, we're scheduled to hold a public hearing to consider designating the Kern Subbasin as a probationary basin under the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We're seeking comments from the public to inform us as we make our decision. And some very encouraging news is that the subbasin is continuing to have technical meetings with staff, and I believe that they will be submitting some further improvements to its plan. So stay tuned for more news on that. And then on February 3rd, and then again tomorrow, State Board staff is holding public workshops to provide an opportunity for the public to discuss a proposed statewide water quality control policy for urban stormwater infiltration. And then lastly, I want to update you on some work in the Russian River watershed related to a telemetry pilot project that our telemetry unit is working on through the Division of Water Rights. On February 12th, the telemetry research unit will be holding a virtual public meeting to discuss this study. And the study's goal is to research how telemetry can streamline data collection and analysis, ultimately reducing the burden on water reporters and improve the usability and availability of water data. The study will test telemetered water monitoring in a real-world setting so that we can better understand costs, logistics, data, and data governance. The request for qualifications for a contractor on this project who will be installing and operating the telemetry equipment, that RFQ was released for bids January 10th, and the bids are due on the 20th of this month. So really excited about this project. There seems to be a lot of interest, and hopefully there'll be a good discussion at the virtual workshop or virtual public meeting on February 12th. And lastly, just want to remind you all to hold your calendars for a two-day water quality WQCC meeting that we have every year in Sacramento. Last fall, we had to cancel it due to budget and other constraints, but we're changing the date. Usually it's in the fall. This year it'll be in the spring because we missed out on that opportunity in the fall, May 1st and 2nd. So hopefully we'll see you all there, and that's all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much, Dee Dee. I've got a burning question and don't mean to put you on the spot, but are we insulated from the theatrics of the new administration?
Well, each day is interesting, as I'm sure we've all seen just in following what's going on in the press. I would just say that of, you know, significant concern is how this impacts funding stream. In particular for the drinking water and wastewater programs. We received some additional funds under the infrastructure package, tried real hard to get a lot of those funds out the door, but I'm not at liberty to say at this point because it's in constant flux, but I hope to be able to provide you with a more detailed update soon. Just know that our Office of Chief Counsel is, you know, closely monitoring this along with our entire executive team and the Division of Financial Assistance.
In light of the forever chemicals, and are there any changes?
We will receive You know, I'll get this out to your executive director. We're going to have an updated information item on PFOA, PFOS. And so I think that there'll be a more detailed discussion about our process as opposed to the federal process. And I'm not remembering when that will be on our calendar, but it'll be, you know, an open public discussion. And so I'll get that date to Ms. Quinto.
Thank you so much, Dee Dee.
Thank you.
Okay, coming up, board chair's report. I just wanted to inform all those present and those listening that just the process of being a board chair, we have a weekly check-in with the executive officer throughout the year, a monthly check-in with the state water board chairs. So all the chairs of the region are on a Zoom meeting platform once a month. And then we have a monthly check-in with our state liaison. So we try to be very as coordinated as possible. And then once a year in Sacramento, there's the WQCC, Water Quality. It's not a convention, but it's a conference where everybody comes together to discuss issues and policies. But that's what I wanted to convey. We're moving on to public forum now.
Mr. Deidre? Chair?
Yes.
May I just provide a brief executive officer report before we move into public forum? Thank you. Very, very brief. I just wanted to take the opportunity while these folks are here to share a couple of staff changes in the office. I mentioned at the last meeting that we've had some kind of exciting shifts in terms of new positions in the office and folks, you know, we're doing recruitment both inside and outside the office, but those new positions have led to some folks moving around. So I wanted to make sure to share that Brian Fuller, who's over in the corner, has been promoted to a senior specialist engineering geologist in our enforcement program. He's been working with the regional board in our enforcement program as an engineering geologist since 2017. So we're excited to see him move into this newly created specialist position for the office. And then I'll also note that Matt Graves, who is an engineering geologist who has been working, I believe, for the last 4 years, working in our planning unit, and he is moving over to our newly created WARU, Watershed Assessment and Recovery Unit, I think is okay. Thank you, folks. We just call it by the acronym internally. So Matt is moving into that unit along with engineering geologist Maggie Robinson and water resource control engineer Lance Lay. And then we have a fourth position that we're still hiring for in that new unit. So exciting to see folks moving around within the organization to fill new roles, and we'll be excited to report to you on the work that those folks are doing in their new positions. Thank you.
Thank you, Valerie, and congratulations to you all. I want to make the statement that I've been on this board since 2016, and I want to tell you that it's an honor and a privilege to be able to work with such high-level people. Thank you for everything you do. Okay, moving on to public forum then.
Just confirming, AGP, you guys can run the timer. Great. We just have one member of the public for public forum joining us via Zoom, Alicia Williams. You should be able to unmute shortly and just state your name and make sure that we can hear you.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Welcome, Alicia.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay, and am I speaking with the chair right now?
Yes.
Okay, so I am here to let you guys know about some pertinent information regarding what's been occurring for a very long time in the Smith River watershed. We have the Easter Lily growers there that have historically used obscene amounts of 25 or so pesticides. And all that information is through DPR. They do an annual report of the sheer quantities of these pesticides and fungicides. And the main problems is with the root nematode and fungus species because of how much water there is in this area. This watershed are wetlands. We are located in a temperate rainforest. We have copious amounts of water that flush these toxicity into our precious waterways. This has been going on for a very long time. The first reported fish die-off was in the early 1950s. There's been a back and forth of struggling to get the Regional Water Board to address concerns, to test and verify the poison causing harm. And then when they did finally come out, and this is all you can find this information lined out at this 40-year report on the government complicity of the death and destruction in the watershed that was put out by Siskiyou Land Conservancy at the end of last year. So there's a lot of data here that you guys need to know about that I feel you guys need to hold a special meeting to go over this or put it on your next regular agenda. I'm going to try just to briefly, you know, state that there's been, in addition to them not coming out when asked to multiple times, then when they did come out in like the early 2000s and then in like the 2017-ish kind of part, they verified and then still didn't take any meaningful action. They just created very complicated processes. Through these management processes, they are not requiring there be any kind of a neutral third party to do the testing, to do the lab and analysis and reporting. They're letting the fox in the hen house do all of this. They've had public outcry saying, we don't want the lily growers reporting the quantities of, reporting the, doing the testing, gathering the water, and then providing the analysis and level reporting. It falls on deaf ears. Now, the most recent highlight came from the Regional Water Board holding public meetings, which they misled the public to believe that when people came and gave their verbal oral testimonies, that those testimonies were going to be considered in part of the lily bulb order. And I come to find out through my diligence in interacting with the Water Board that no, in fact, they didn't record any of those oral testimony. And in fact, when I requested the testimony sign-in sheet that everybody was made to fill out at the Smith River Methodist Church on October 21st, 2024, they could not and would not provide it to me. And they, in fact, buried that information so that we wouldn't be able to tie back to those individuals to get their testimony written down. That is only one instance of deceptive practices and them purposely suppressing speech of the oppressed people in our area. I have an email that I can forward to you that goes over the history of oppression in the Smith River area, specifically where the homeland of the Tolowa are. And then we also have the migrant workers that are being affected as well. They're also, they have a lot of plight in their history as well, and they're being really affected right now. But historically, it's been the Tolowa that have been affected. We also have the white people being affected for at least 40 years, if not longer, probably closer to 70 years. They have a notoriously high cancer rate in Smith River. There's been so much blind eye on this that it's disgusting. It's disgusting. It's all documented. So back to the Water Board's culpability. They have been suppressing speech. They have changed at the last minute the public meeting forum from Smith River, where this occurs, where the growers are, where the Tolowa are, where the migrant workers are, where the affected whites are. They have moved it to Zoom. Okay, at the last minute, when I asked them why they did that, they refused to tell me why. They said it was because some people, quote unquote, were uncomfortable with that meeting location when they've met there before at the hall across from Lucky Seven Casino and the homeland of the Tolowa. So there's been so much deceptive practices. There's been so much misconduct. There's been so much denying of our environmental laws from the county. I'll be done in 5 seconds. From the county level, the state level, and the federal level, it's unacceptable. I'm pleading with this Water Board Authority today to please understand that government's obligation and duty is to protect the general public from harm. The Water Board is not lawfully allowed to give preferential treatment to those in positions of power with greater resources of funding and legal advocacy, such as the lily growers, which I did hear you, Greg, Vice Chair, advocate for the lily growers right before this meeting and say that they are wanting to maintain a quote unquote neutral tone. Okay, I can read through that. And that is BS. And I'm calling you out on that, Alicia, right now. We do not want advocacy.
Alicia, thank you. And additionally, I appreciate
to honor your values to protect all people from harm caused by contamination of our sacred water sources. And again, I'm calling for at least a special meeting, if not this, to be put on the agenda for the next regular
Alicia,
schedule.
Let me speak, Alicia. Thank you so much. I really appreciate your passion and all that you're bringing forth. A lot of us don't know the details. May I ask, how are you connected with the area? Do you live there? Hello?
Okay, so can you hear me now? They muted me.
Yes.
Alicia,
it's my turn to speak. How are you connected with this area? Do you live in the Smith River?
I heard your question. I was answering it. So I moved to the Smith River itself and was living there at the RV park. That's right up north. A quarter of a mile from Lucky Seven Casino.
Okay. So I believe we have a meeting scheduled for that area and coming up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are working on planning a meeting up in Del Norte County to give the board an informational update about the permit development process and about the data that staff have collected in the watershed. We don't yet have a date for that meeting. So we'll be, after this board meeting, we'll be communicating with board members about availability for what probably will need to be a special meeting in order to get up to Del Norte County. So we'll be in touch about that. And then I also just want to remind board members and the public that if folks have questions about the permit development process before then, you know, of course our staff are available to connect with interested people as they have with Ms. Williams. Sorry, I'm hearing an echo and getting distracted. back in August, we published an executive officer's report article that outlined both the history of the Water Board's work with these issues and also the projected milestones for the permit development process. So just wanted to make sure that folks were available, that information is out there and available in advance of us scheduling a dedicated meeting to talk about this topic.
Great. Thank you, Valerie. So I want to read this comment, Counselor, if I may.
Yep, please go ahead.
I want to remind the commenter that the board values public input and strives to maintain a respectful and orderly process for the public to comment on matters with the board's purview. With this in mind, when those presenting comments in this public forum, whether in person or online, become abusive, disorderly, or otherwise impact the ability of the board to maintain an open dialogue with the public, I may have to ask the person to refrain from further comment and, if online, ask staff to mute their microphone or remove access to the forum. So going forward, to maintain decorum and orderliness, we will have that in effect. Thank you. And thank you, Alicia. We're moving on. Is there anyone else in public forum?
No, that's all.
Thank you. So that moves us to election of board officers.
Mr. Chair.
Sir.
You sure you want me to do this? I move for another full term of chairmanship that Hector Bedoya serve one more term as chair.
I so second.
Deidre, will you call for the vote, please? Or any comments? Deidre, call for the vote.
Does Chair Bedoya, do you vote on this? Or?
Aye.
Okay.
That's all I need to hear.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Board Member Hart?
Aye.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
I got who? You want to do it? No, I'll do it.
So you're not retired, Mr. Honorable Chair.
Might have to get him a permanent plaque up here. And then transferring the burdens of power for all the money and the glory, I would like to nominate Alex Hart for vice chair for one full term.
Second.
I'll second up.
All right. Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Hart?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
So you're going to witness the peaceful transfer of power.
And I'm just going to add, I'm honored, and I hope I do you all proud. I'm in great hands up here. They are a wealth of knowledge, and I am humbled by their support. So I thank you.
Thank you. I would entertain a motion to approve the meeting minutes for December 4th and 5th, 2024.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Second.
Chair Bedoya?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hart?
Aye.
Board Member Giusti?
Aye.
Board Member Sundberg?
Aye.
Board Member McKenzie?
Aye.
Thank you. That moves us to an information item. Information item on North Coast water bodies in integrated report 303D list. By Mary Bartholomew.
Okay. Perfect, thank you. Okay, so looks like we're set up. Good morning, my name is Mary Bartholomew. I'm presenting item three, an update on the 2026 integrated report. And I am the co-lead of the integrated report program in the watershed adaptive management unit with engineering geologist Matt Graves. And Also present remotely are Kira Tuso and Sammy Mishishida from the State Water Resources Control Board, who would be available to answer questions. In this informational presentation, I will start with a description of the purpose of the presentation and then provide an overview of the integrated report and give a summary of the water quality assessment for the North Coast region before I review highlights from our 2026 comprehensive assessment, describe our off-cycle work for the 2028 integrated report, and close with a discussion about the public review and participation process for the Integrated Reports 303D list. The State Board compiles comprehensive assessments of surface water quality by regional boards every 2 years. However, each watershed in the state is assessed every 6 years when the regional board is termed on cycle. The years in green are when the North Coast Regional Water Board performs a comprehensive assessment of surface waters. The North Coast Regional Board was last on cycle in 2018, is currently on cycle for the 2026 Integrated Report, will be doing targeted off-cycle work during the 2028 Integrated Report, which is highlighted in yellow, and will next be on cycle for a comprehensive assessment for the 2032 Integrated Report. Our current assessment leads me to the purpose for this presentation. The purpose of this presentation is to share information and answer questions about the outcomes of the 2026 Comprehensive Integrated Report, describe the work we'll be doing off-cycle for the 2028 Integrated Report, and describe how people may review and comment on the 2026 303D list. All formal comments regarding the North Coast Regional Board's 303D list recommendations must be made to the State Board in a process that I'll describe at the end of the presentation. The Integrated Report was composed of two requirements of the Clean Water Act, which I'll describe next. The Integrated Report is composed of Clean Water Act Section 305B report and the Clean Water Act Section 303D list. Each regional board assesses water quality in their region, identifies how well designated and protected beneficial uses are being supported in the 305B report, and updates changes to the impairment listings in the 303D list. The State Water Resources Control Board leads the public participation process, considers approval of the regional board's 303D lists, and combines all regional board integrated reports into a single California report, which is submitted to the United States Protection Agency every 2 years. The US EPA has the final approval authority over the 303D list, and then they take the 305B portion from all states, combine them into a national water quality inventory, and use that to report on the condition of the nation's water to the United States Congress. Whether a beneficial use supports a water body is recorded in a decision. This is a decision process we follow to develop the 303D list, where we determine if a pollutant supports beneficial uses. This slide shows the decision to list or not to list a water body pollutant pair on the 303D list of impaired water bodies. We use a statewide water quality control policy for developing California's Clean Water Act Section 303D list, which is referred to as the listing policy. In general, for the listing policy, we first assess data against a water quality objective and determine how many samples exceed the threshold. Based on the proportion of the number of exceedances out of the total number of samples, we decide whether a pollutant statistically impairs a water body. If the previous decision was list because the water body was impaired, our current decision is either do not delist if it is still impaired or delist if it is no longer impaired by the pollutant. And likewise, if a decision it was do not list because the water body was either not impaired or there wasn't enough data to make a decision, our current decision is either do not list if the water body remains unimpaired, or list if there is now an impollutant. We repeat making this decision about beneficial use support for each water body pollutant pair. The 305B report and the 303D list are prepared from decisions. And again, a decision is a determination of whether a pollutant in a water body supports beneficial uses using the listing policy. For the 2026 integrated report, we made 4,833 decisions. In context, we made about 2,000 more decisions than when we were last on cycle for the 2018 integrated report. So what were the decisions for the North Coast Regional Board? We made decisions about water body pollutant pairs in these pollutant categories. This table is a summary of the number of decisions we made per pollutant category, along with the number of proposed new 303D listings and listings. For listings, the greatest number of new 303D listings are in the other cause category, which is composed of pollutants which don't fit in one of the listed categories. And all of the proposed 303D delistings are indicator bacteria in the pathogens category. Some delistings were due to a change in methodology, and one was due to an improvement in water quality. The Russian River at Healdsburg Memorial Beach now fully supports water contract recreation, the Rec 1 beneficial use, and I'll describe the changes to the pathogens evaluations later in this presentation. So how does this break down for each watershed? This is a table of the number of decisions in each watershed, along with the proposed new 303D listings and delistings. Water bodies are segmented into smaller portions for the integrated report process. Each decision represents a pollutant assessed for a water body segment. The Russian River watershed has the most proposed new listings, and again, all of the proposed delistings are for indicator bacteria. These results are used to compose the overall condition categories. These are the overall condition categories for the integrated report. This slide shows the number of water bodies in each condition category and the number of associated decisions for the North Coast region. The California Integrator Report places water bodies into one of five condition categories based on the water body's ability to support beneficial uses in the 305B report. Category 1 is when all beneficial uses are supported. Category 2 is when there is insufficient data to determine beneficial use support. Category 3 is when there is insufficient data to determine beneficial use support, but the beneficial use may be threatened. And an example of that is where the non-contact water recreation Rec 2 beneficial use may be impaired due to trash, but there isn't spatial data for the assessment. Category 4 is where a water body is impaired, but a TMDL is not required because the impairment is being addressed. And Category 5 is where the water body is impaired and a TMDL is required because the water body is yet to be addressed. The impairment is yet to be addressed. The 303D list consists of water body pollutant combinations placed in Categories 4 and 5 in red. Next, I'll highlight a few of the decisions we've made for the 2026 integrated report. The first highlight is for indicator bacteria in the Russian River watershed. The current 303D listings map shows the current extents of the 303D listings for indicator bacteria in the Russian River watershed. The two extents circled on the map are Stream 1 on Fitch Mountain and a nearby portion of the Russian River, just because they're small and may be overlooked. And the proposed 303D listings map shows the proposed revised extents for the 303D list. And the circle on that map is to draw attention to the Monte Rio Beach area, just also because it's small and it's a proposed new 303D listing for indicator bacteria. For the 2026 integrated report, the statewide inland bacteria water quality objective for the water contact recreation Rec 1 beneficial use has changed from assessing fecal coliform to E. coli for freshwater and Enterococcus for saline water. Fecal coliform and freshwater Enterococcus lines of evidence used in previous Rec 1 beneficial use indicator bacteria decisions were not included in the 2026 integrated report. Additionally, in accordance with the listing policy, data should be representative of the critical timing that the pollutant is expected to impact the water body. Lacking constant inputs, indicator bacteria do not persist in the environment for a long period of time, and the effects are of relatively short duration. And as a result, the historic levels of E. coli in a water body may be a poor indicator of current risks to human health, particularly when more recent data are available to assess the water quality standard. Historic lines of evidence for data collected prior to October 21st, 2012, which are data collected more than 10 years from the close of the data solicitation deadline for the 2026 integrated report, were not evaluated when more recent data were available. So how have the indicator bacteria 303 delistings changed for the Russian River? The next two slides summarize the proposed changes to the Russian River indicator bacteria 303 delistings. For Guerneville, the main stem Russian River supports the Rec 1 beneficial use, except for Monte Rio Beach and Dutch Bill Creek had outdated data. We propose to delist everything currently listed for the Guerneville hydrologic subarea and list the Monte Rio Beach area. For Green Valley Creek, the data was both outdated and insufficient in quantity to determine beneficial use listings for the watershed other than for Green Valley Creek. We propose to delist everything currently listed for the Green Valley Creek watershed except for the main stem of Green Valley Creek. For Geyserville, Stream 1 on Fitch Mountain data were outdated, so we propose to delist the stream.
May I ask a question?
Yes.
How old was that data that was outdated?
Well, the data for Fitch Mountain was 20 years old.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. For the Laguna de Santa Rosa and Santa Rosa Creek, the only listings that we have changed are for tributaries. If the water quality objective exceedances were all sum for all tributaries for the Laguna de Santa Rosa or for Santa Rosa Creek, there are enough exceedances to place the water body on the 303D list. However, if each stream is assessed independently, no single stream has enough exceedances to be listed. Therefore, we are proposing to delist the tributaries. The main stem Laguna de Santa Rosa and main stem Santa Rosa Creek are proposed to remain on the 303D list.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, if I might. When you're talking about the Laguna de Santa Rosa and its tributaries, are you talking about Copeland Creek, Heinbach Creek, the various creeks that run through the city of Rohnert Park into the Laguna de Santa Rosa? It's very difficult to tell from the maps. They're so small as to exactly what's represented.
So it was listed for the entire water body. I was looking to see if there was only an extent listing for previously. And so for all of the tributaries that would feed into Santa Rosa Creek, so all of those would be delisted.
Yeah, I'm wondering if I should be concerned as your representative here from the city of Santa Rosa, just in terms of these listings. I was not aware of this level of contamination. And so is there a concern for the public health represented by these listings?
There would be a concern for water contact recreation and incidental ingestion of water or perhaps a rash development from contact.
Mr. Chair, to the executive officer, is this something that should be communicated to the city of Rohnert Park, for example, or are they well aware?
I believe the local governments in the Russian River watershed are well aware of the pathogen impairments and also the regional board's efforts to develop a pathogen TMDL for the Russian River watershed, including the Laguna. And so it's my understanding that the local governments are aware and just also want to note that in terms of those concerns for public health, we are bringing back another crack at that Russian River pathogen TMDL, anticipating actually bringing a workshop to the board in April and an adoption hearing in June. So there will be more action on this topic coming soon.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I realize that I'm a board member here and not representing the city of Rohnert Park itself, but I just wanted to be sure that there's communication going on, and certainly this workshop in April be a good time. Thank you very much.
So these tributaries are ephemeral. Some are ephemeral, depending on the size of the watershed, and so they dry up in the spring and summer. But others have contamination from homeless encampments, not necessarily industrial, but maybe leaky septic systems or grazing, fecal matter, and flooding. But this is great information. Thank you.
Okay. So our next highlight is for the Klamath River. The second highlight regards the Klamath River dam removals. This slide shows J.C. Boyle Dam in Oregon and COPCO 1, COPCO 2, and Iron Gate Dams in California. They were removed from the Klamath River in 2024, 2 years after the close of the data solicitation process for the 2026 integrated report. For the integrated report, we assess all, quote-unquote, readily available data and information. However, the listing policy states that if there is a new management practice, we only assess the data since the implementation of the management measure, and due to the dam removals, we are revising how we evaluate data collected from the main stem Klamath River. Because the removal of the dams has significantly changed the Klamath River hydrology, and the data submitted for the integrated report represents conditions prior to the dam removals, data for COPCO 1 Reservoir, COPCO 2 Reservoir, Iron Gate Reservoir, and the main stem Klamath River were not assessed for the 2026 integrated report. Data collected and submitted after drawdowns will be assessed in future integrated reports.
So a quick question. Do the tribes collect data, and do we integrate with them on having their data meshed with ours?
If they submit the data to the federal database, I think it's WQX database, it's uploaded and incorporated into our integrated report. If they don't submit it there, we haven't incorporated it. We also, my very next slide, the next update is about how we don't assess data collected on tribal land. And so if it was a water body on a tribal land, then we also wouldn't assess it even if it was submitted. We can go there now. So the final highlight is regards to data collected on tribal lands. This slide shows water quality sampling stations on and off the Round Valley Reservation, and that the North Coast region has the greatest number of sampling stations located on tribal lands. Data and information collected from water bodies and federally recognized tribal lands by any entity, tribal or non-tribal, will not be assessed for the integrated report because the state of California does not have the authority to administer the Clean Water Act with respect to federally recognized tribal lands, and the US EPA does not approve any Clean Water Act Section 303D listing recommendations made by the state for waters under the jurisdiction of federally recognized tribes.
Mr. Chair. Mary, I'm just trying to stay tuned in here. So the last slide was about the Klamath. Now that you talked about the North Region, 181 approximate stations. You're showing Round Valley, which is on the Eel River, not the Klamath. I'm assuming not all 181 stations are on those red blocks there.
No, this is just an example. An example of sampling stations that are located both on and off. So the sampling station, the round yellow round circle on the tribal land, we would not assess that data, but the data that's not in the red area, we would assess data from those stations.
Perfect. Thank you.
I'll note that
Excuse me, Mary?
Yeah.
So the lack of interaction between the state or our regional board and the tribes, is that just a policy, state policy? I mean, we interact on other issues, and I'm all about collaboration. Are there instances where we do collaborate with them on water issues, on water quality issues?
Yes.
Let's say there's a spill.
Okay.
Do we just hands off?
I'm not sure what we do with spills.
Mary, I can jump in.
It would be good to have a overarching policy to address hazards or hazardous situations, emergency situations.
Yeah, Chair Boudreau, Catherine may have some additions to this as well, but the main reason for the water, for this effort, for the integrated report, that we don't connect with the tribes in that way is that the regional boards don't have authority over their land for that aspect. It would be them setting their own standards, and then they would work with EPA through the federal process. We collaborate with the tribes on other issues extensively, both through all of our AB 52, SB 2108 work. We do consultations with them on significant projects. So we definitely have a strong coordination with them. For cleanup specifically on their land, that, and I know that EPA would be the folks they would call in on their lands, or on the coastal zone, it would be the U.S. Coast Guard on a spill. I'm unsure of how our agency would engage on tribal land if there were a spill, but my guess is if that spill threatened land outside of that tribal land, which most spills do, right? They move downstream, then we would be engaged, as would the state. And
well, just as an exercise, if the administration gutted the ability of that coordination of work in an emergency situation, how could we help a tribe in our region?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that as state staff we're
maybe I'm going on
really at liberty to speculate about how we would respond with sort of theoretical happenings with the relationship with the federal government. So
thank you.
I think at this time we'll definitely if things change and we have operational changes, we'll report those as needed. But I don't think we're in a position to speculate right now.
Great,
but it's a great question.
And I'll note, did you have something?
Sorry, I can't resist adding Catherine Carter of your staff, division supervisor of the Planning Watershed Stewardship Division. Mary's doing an amazing job. I just wanted to reinforce that tribes have always been some of our strongest partners. Their ability to collect data and inform and help inform conditions is extremely valuable, and we really do work closely with them in many of our programs outside of the regulatory environment, including the Surface Water Ambient Monitoring Program. And I guess I will bring up the Klamath Fish Health Assessment Team, KFAT. Some of you have heard us come to and speak of that group, which monitors conditions on the Klamath to see if there's a threat of a fish kill. That crew is an example of how we've set up a system where tribal lands, where they have sovereignty, we are invited to participate in data collection when they ask us. So I would envision that in a scenario where they have some questions for us and they invite us, we certainly will partner with them, but we understand tribal sovereignty and want to respect that. And in terms of the integrated report, it is a relic that we historically had evaluated data on tribal lands. The tribes actually would submit data. They were very active in participating in the meetings on the integrated report and giving us feedback about the listings, including on their lands. And it was just the decision to not evaluate data through integrated report was made because the US EPA is the entity that has the ability to determine if those listings are warranted because the state does not have jurisdiction. And the US EPA was not picking up those evaluations and doing anything. So in a sense, it was an effort that was didn't come to any outcome. And so until the tribes and the EPA have worked out how they would like that done, we are not going to be assessing data on tribal lands as part of our state process.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. To note, though, that the state board is conducting outreach to tribes, and if a tribe is interested in our assessments, we are committed to working with them to determine approaches for future integrated report assessments. So they have sent letters to tribes. I don't believe that we've received a reply, but I believe the replies would have gone to the state board, but I haven't heard of a reply from a tribe in our region. So now I'll discuss our proposed off-cycle work for the 2028 integrated report. So this presentation is about the 2026 integrated report, but I wanted to touch on two things that we're working on off-cycle for the 2028 integrated report. The first task is to remap the water body segments for the portion of the Russian River. The Klamath River. As discussed in the highlights, dams have been removed from the Klamath River, and prior to these dams, we assessed water body in the reservoirs. So with the dam removals, we need to remap the assessed water body segments to reflect the current hydrologic conditions. And the second task is to assess more bacteria data for the Russian River watershed. We will assess data that Sonoma County and the cities have collected within the past 10 years from numerous sampling locations shown on the map. And this is a priority because it is important to use for us to show responsiveness to this water body pollutant since it's been proven contentious, and to make every effort to ensure that the 303D listings are up to date. I'll conclude the presentation with information on how to participate in the 2026 integrated report public comment period. These are ways to participate in the 2026 integrated report. The State Water Resources Control Board leads the public participation process in coordination with regional boards. The State Water Board's Water Quality Assessment webpage contains links to the draft staff report and public notice, which contains instructions on how to submit comments to the 303D list. I've included both a webpage address and a QR code that links to the Water Quality Assessment webpage. The draft staff report for the 2026 integrated report was released on January 30th, which was last Thursday, and is available for public comment through noon on April 2nd. Written comments may be submitted by email following the comment instructions found in the public notice. And the State Water Board will hold a staff workshop next week. The workshop will be designed to help people understand the integrated report process, and public comments will not be recorded at that meeting, at the workshop, but oral comments will be recorded at the March 18th State Board hearing for the 2026 integrated report. And finally, the 303D list is proposed to go to the State Board for consideration of adoption at their January 20th, 2026 board meeting. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much. Board members, do you have any questions?
Not a question. It's just it's a copious amount of information that you're dealing with, Mary, and I really appreciate the way you laid it out for us today. And I'm glad I was, and I think others in this room remember, I was quite annoyed when the state took the lead away from our regional board to do this. But I find assurances that, you know, people like you are involved and others that are diligently giving us this kind of information. So I just wanted to take this time to say thank you and doing a good job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions here. Back in slides 8 and 9, I was interested in the pesticide numbers that showed up. Probably 9 would be the one to pull up in the screen. Excuse me, we have... Okay, yeah, Smith River, number of decisions, 776, but number of new listings is 5. What does that reflect? Does that reflect 5 different samplings that occurred in the Smith River, or...
That is water body segments. That so for the Smith River, it applies to alkalinity in Delilah Creek, in Diuron and Morrison Creek, Ritmer Creek, and the Smith River watershed as a larger component of, and then temperature in the Smith River estuary.
Okay, and I know that we're going to be coming back to the Smith River question later on this year, but I just happened to notice that. It's very difficult in the Russian River slides to see exactly which was where. Are there larger maps in existence that one could look at, or... Are they printed out anywhere, or would I go on my laptop and blow them up? That's just a mechanical question as to what's going on in the Russian River area. I would note that the executive officer, senior staff, and myself were at the North Coast Resource Partnership meetings at the Federated Indians of Grayton Rancheria Resort last week, and there was a massive tribal presence and a number of presentations that were made there. And I know that the executive officer and others are in communication with the tribes, but it's certainly a resource that... we should be keeping in touch with. Leif Hillman is the co-chair, along with Supervisor Gore of NCRP. So I was very pleased to see that we were well represented at that. My final question is, when this report eventually goes to Water Division in Region 9, do they do any analysis of the findings? Do they react to this report, or do they simply pass it on to the water people in EPA headquarters, assuming that there will still be an EPA headquarters in a couple of years? But I'm serious about the question as to whether Region 9 staff review this report and make any sort of recommendations or take any actions?
They review the 303D list, and they either approve it or partially approve it. And they can and have and will make changes to our listing recommendations.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mary. Very, very timely and very detailed. Good. Okay. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Folks, I think we'll take a 10-minute break. Sorry, folks, we got carried away with coffee cake, and anyway, I was reminded that we overlooked public comment on the integrated report. Deidre, were there commenters from the public?
Yes, I just wanted to check with Bart and Alicia, or I'm sorry, Bart and Brenda, if you wanted to comment on the integrated report item. I'll quickly unmute you so you can let us know if you would like to comment. Brenda, I see your hand raised. Could you unmute and state your name to make sure we can hear you?
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm Brenda Edelman from Russian River Watershed Protection Committee. And I just have a few comments. And basically, my understanding is that the segment of the Russian River between Guerneville and Montereau has been delisted. But I'm a little bit confused after today's presentation and want to validate whether that's true and that there's a new segment for the Montereau Beach area, upstream and downstream 200 meters. And I just want to check and make sure if I understood that correctly. But the other thing I wanted to let you know was that I am aware of studies of nutrients and pathogens on the lower river that have been going on for 15 years now, since about 2010. And that is, your agency helped set up a program in relation to the biological opinion that would test the river for these constituents every year between May 15th and October 1st, again, for the pathogens and the nutrients. And I have all of those studies. They were taken weekly. They were taken regularly on the beach, Johnson's Beach or Vacation Beach, and also Montereau Beach, and one other just downstream, the name escapes me right now. And the studies indicate that there was virtually no E. coli found on a weekly basis at any of those beaches over a 15-year period. And I think this is very significant information, and it definitely justifies the delisting of most of that area. And I'm just basically wanting to check in and see if I have interpreted that accurately. And I'm also curious, I don't have any information on continuing studies and what the findings are on that. But I definitely would like to see the studies from the biological opinion work included in whatever data that you consider for these listings. So at any rate, I'd be curious about any comments from board or staff. I know I have to submit it to the state. I would also submit it to your agency. And just wondering if the board has any comments or suggestions for me as to further information on how to get that part of the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Brenda. Mary, do you have any comments on this?
Yes, first of all, to verify that the stretch of the Russian River that was previously listed to I already gave away my listings notes, but they have been delisted, the portion that you were talking about for confirmation, and in that stretch, the only portion that remains listed is the Monte Rio Beach area. So your understanding there is correct. And then I had a conversation with Brenda Edelman on the phone yesterday, and she described the work she had. We get, thank you. Let me go to, so it was the Main Stem Russian River at Healdsburg Memorial. It was from Fife Creek to Dutchbill Creek, I believe is the stretch that you're referring to that was listed. And we're proposing to delist all of that except for the area at Monte Rio Beach. And then in the conversation yesterday, we receive the county samples during the summer at beaches for AB411 program for swimmers for human health risks. And we received that data, and that data is used in the integrated report. She was describing data, and she said it was different data, and I'm just not aware of it. So she's going to send it, and then once I get to take a look at it, I'll see if it's something that we incorporate or if it's something to solicit for our next integrated report. I'm not 100% sure about whether or not we already are using the data from the description of it.
Thank you, Mary. Board members, any comments? Brenda, thank you for your comments and concerns, and always appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Deidre, is there another one?
Bart Diemer, if you can unmute and let us know if you would like to comment on this item.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, I'm Bart Diemer. I'm a septic system owner in Northwood along the Russian River near Monte Rio. I'm a member of OATS RRR, a citizens group of OATS owners along the river from Fitch Mountain to Villa Grande. I have a few questions about the practical impact of the proposed listing at Monte Rio Beach. I gather that this listing would put OATS or septic systems within 200 yards into Tier 3 under the statewide OATS policy. The beach is a pretty good-sized beach, so my first question is, where is the point from which the 200 yards would be measured? And second, will a map be published to show who's in and who's out? And my final question is, how many OATS would be inside this new Tier 3 area? Thank you.
Thank you, Bart. Mary, any comments on this?
So for where it's measured from, it's measured from a target monitoring location. So when you develop a monitoring location, you have a target, and that's where you're headed to. But where you exactly sample from might be like a few feet one direction or another. So you have your actual sampling location and your target sampling locations. And so we it's based on the target sampling location.
Will you be creating a map for homeowners to look at?
I can talk to Lisa Bernard and Kelsey Cody with our office. They're working with the on-site wastewater treatment system map in the TMDL. It's not something that I'm working with. Mm-hmm. It's a different program. So it's like he had one question, the Monte Rio Beach, and then our listing policy has a sampling station is considered the same sampling station if it's 200 meters from the target location. And so we have, we determine the area by 200 feet upstream and downstream because it's 200 meters from the sampling location, and that's where we got our 200 meters from. That's measured where, will we make a map? The map, we can make a map. I didn't make a map because it's not part of my program. But I can definitely talk to people who want to see a map. And then how many aughts are in Tier 3? And so Tier 3 for the on-site wastewater treatment system policy has additional requirements if you have indicator bacteria exceedances within, I think it's within a certain distance from the water body. So all of those septic systems would have additional requirements for them. And I don't know how many septic systems are in that area.
It would be great. It would be great to create diagrams, sketches, maps for homeowners in all those regions that are affected so they're not given a big surprise and an obligation to redo their septic systems.
Okay.
Greg?
Mr. Chair, question for Executive Officer. Charles Reed has always taken the lead on talking to this board about the aughts and all of those. Who should Bart, I don't want to put Mary on the spot because we're asking her to go beyond her program responsibilities, but who should Bart talk to get specific answers to his, you know, very valid questions?
Charles is still involved, and I imagine that that Bart has a line of communication with him. In addition, Kelsey Cody, as Mary mentioned, is one of the seniors in Charles's division and the senior over the groundwater permitting unit that deals with on-site wastewater treatment systems. So they're both very engaged with these issues and also engaged with the Russian River Pathogen TMDL, which speaks to many of these issues. And again, you'll be hearing a lot more about that in April.
Well, Bart, thank you for your comments. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, moving on. Hearing officer's statement for hearing. This is the time and place for a public hearing to consider whether to issue an order for administrative civil liability to Bodine Company Incorporated. This matter comes to the board based on the prosecution's team's allegations in administrative civil liability complaint R1-2021-0047-A related to the operations at Bodine's Markwest Quarry facility. The board will conduct this hearing in accordance with the notice of public hearing and hearing procedure document that was issued and the instructions I provide. In this matter, we have separated the functions of staff between those who are acting in a prosecutorial role, who comprise the prosecution team, and will be advocating for the proposed liability, and those neutral staff advisors who comprise the advisory team and will advise the board in its consideration of this matter. The advisory team includes the board's executive officer, counsel to the board, and designated technical staff. The prosecution team and respondent Bodine are the parties in this matter, and they will introduce themselves as the hearing proceeds. The parties are both subject to the same rules and regulations as discussed in the hearing procedure. This includes the prohibition on ex parte or one-sided communication with board members and the advisory team. Are there any ex parte communications that the parties, board members, or members of the advisory team wish to disclose? There being none, I will continue. The complaint that the board has received from the prosecution team seeks penalties for alleged violations related to Bodine's Mark West Quarry operation. Bodine's operation is enrolled under the Industrial General Stormwater Permit. The prosecution team seeks $8,589,406 in penalties related to alleged permit violations at the quarry. Bodine challenges the complaint and the prosecution team's proposed penalties, asserting they are not supported factually or legally. The prosecution team and Bodine have submitted arguments and evidence in support of their positions, and each have submitted proposed orders for the board's consideration. The prosecution team has the burden of proof in this case and must prove the allegations are supported by a preponderance of evidence. During this hearing, the board will consider the evidence submitted by the parties, testimony, and argument to determine whether the alleged violations are supported, and if so, what penalties should be issued. I remind the parties that the board has required the submission of written evidence in accordance with the hearing notice and procedure, and new evidence will generally not be allowed during this hearing. This includes the presentations that the parties intend to give that should only include already submitted evidence. These presentations have been provided to the advisory team and copied to the other party and will be admitted into the record. I want to note that the board has the discretion to refuse to admit late evidence or testimony where submission requirements have not been met. I do not approve of the practice of submitting evidence late. Late evidence can impact the board's ability to hold a fair and efficient hearing, and consistent with our regulations, I will refuse to accept late evidence when it would be prejudicial to a party or the board. Only upon showing of severe hardship will I modify this rule. As noted in my pre-hearing ruling, I have accepted certain late evidence submitted by the prosecution team, but only because there were factors that clearly showed a lack of prejudice. The ruling should not be read as the board generally tolerated late submittals. I will scrutinize any evidence that is not timely submitted and will not admit it if there is a showing of prejudice to a party or the board. As I noted, I issued a ruling on various objections to evidence prior to the hearing. I have a few follow-up points on that ruling. First, a reminder to the parties regarding certain evidence submitted by respondent Bodine. I understand that the parties will discuss statements made by a former regional water board employee regarding stormwater compliance at regulated facilities, including Bodine's facility. As I stated in my ruling, I will not entertain extensive character witness testimony about this employee. The value of such evidence is low and will be an unnecessary distraction to this proceeding. The parties are free to discuss the evidence and reliability of the comments, but extensive character testimony is not necessary and will involve an undue use of time. Additionally, my ruling deferred a decision on the admissibility of certain evidence offered by the prosecution team. This evidence was many reports, photographs, and other documents that lack sufficient information to verify their authenticity and relevance. My ruling stated that the prosecution team could provide witness testimony at the hearing to support this evidence. Late last week, the prosecution team submitted written witness declarations asserting that the board, for efficiency reasons, should accept these declarations instead of requiring prosecution team to provide witness testimony at the hearing to support the evidence. Bodine has objected to these witness declarations as this written testimony was submitted past the deadline for submission of written evidence. Before ruling on these declarations. I would like to hear from the prosecution team about why the board should accept these written witness declarations, explain why they were not submitted earlier, and why it is not prejudicial to admit them. I would also like to hear from Bodine and their objection to admitting these declarations. I'll hear from the prosecution team first.
Good morning. This is Naomi Rubin, counsel for the prosecution team. The hearing procedures seek to avoid the introduction of surprise testimony and exhibits and minimize the need for oral argument and testimony at hearing. In doing so, they require the parties to submit documentary evidence, witness information, and legal and technical memoranda prior to the hearing. The prosecution team did just that. And while California Code of Regulations Section 648.4 permit the presiding officer to require the submission of written testimony prior to the hearing, they do not require it. Contrary to the argument in Bodine's motion to dismiss filed last night, which included a very selective quote of the Code of Regulations section, governing law does not require the submission of written testimony prior to hearing, and notably, the hearing procedures for this matter did not require that here. These declarations are written testimony. The underlying exhibits and documentary evidence to which they refer were submitted with the prosecution team's case in chief or with its rebuttal. The declarations are written testimony for the purpose of authenticating this evidence in response to the advisory team's ruling on Bodine's evidentiary objections, to which the prosecution team was barred from replying. Clearly, the prosecution team would be permitted to elicit the testimony contained in the declarations on direct examination. The declarations are all from witnesses listed on the prosecution team's witness lists and are within the scope of the topics to which each of these witnesses was designated to testify. That these 13 witnesses are testifying on these topics is of no surprise to anyone and causes no prejudice to Bodine. In fact, submission of the declarations has afforded Bodine with more of an opportunity to prepare cross-examination than it would otherwise have had the prosecution team elicited the testimony for the first time on direct at hearing. The hearing procedures specify that the proceeding shall be conducted in accordance with the provisions and rules of evidence set forth in Government Code Section 11513. That section establishes that the hearing need not be conducted according to technical rules relating to evidence and witnesses. Spending a significant portion of hearing time on authentication in this administrative proceeding was not expected or reasonably foreseeable based on the hearing procedures and the governing law. The prosecution team has been prejudiced by first being prohibited from responding at all to Bodine's evidentiary objections prior to the issuance of the January 24th ruling, and by the fact that this ruling was issued after the deadline for requesting more hearing time had passed. To the extent that the declarations are not accepted into the record, the prosecution team again respectfully requests that extra time be afforded to it so that witnesses can read their declarations into the record. But the presiding officer has the authority to avoid this waste of time. Spending lengthy time soliciting testimony for the purpose of authenticating what, for the most part, are this agency's records and to assuage hearsay concerns is a waste of resources and a waste of time of the parties, the board, and the public. Acceptance of the declarations will further the hearing procedure's goals of minimizing the time needed for live testimony at the hearing and will cause no prejudice to Bodine. We respectfully request that they be admitted. Thank you.
Thank you. Sean Hungerford for Bodine. So, good enough? Thank you. So, these declarations are intended to support the prosecution team's case in chief. And the deadline for the prosecution team to submit their case in chief was back in August. And they didn't do that. That was the deadline for them to submit technical analysis, any evidence in support of their claims, and any argument in support of their claims. They didn't do that. Our objections are centered on the fact that this information is new information that's submitted to this board well past the deadlines. On the question of prejudice, I would just point out that in the ruling that allowed, that led us to where we're at, and the advisory team, I'm sorry, the chair, noted that records were produced too distant in time from the inspection. Records reports were authored by multiple staff, and many reports were prepared by memory. These declarations don't answer those questions. In fact, they raise more questions than answers. And I'll note that some of these staff reports were submitted months after the time that the inspection occurred. You know, if we go back to 2018, we have a December 18 inspection that was submitted 4 months after the inspection, a January inspection, 4 months after the inspection they were submitted. We have months of delay between the actual inspections and the submittal of these reports. These declarations simply just say, these are my reports and they're accurate. They make no effort to explain the reasons for the delay, you know, what happened in the interim, how the reports were prepared. Were they prepared from notes? Were they prepared from memory? Particularly for those inspection reports that quote conversations happening between Bodine staff and the water board's inspectors while on site. So the prejudice to Bodine is that if these are allowed, then it requires us to spend time cross-examining these witnesses on this new evidence in the form of these declarations that we didn't have 2 weeks ago. And I just remind the board that we have 5 hours to present, well, not only our case in chief, but cross-examination, opening statements, closing statements, and that isn't much time. So we already have a full presentation that already is going to be busting at the seams a little bit in order to cover the ground that we want to cover in the time that we have. To spend additional time cross-examining the prosecution team's witnesses on these declarations is prejudicial to us because we're losing precious time that we'd rather spend covering other things in front of this board.
Okay, we will. I'd like to ask the board to, if you have any comments or discussion.
To be clear, Mr. Chair, you read in your opening statement that you had earlier denied or requested that the prosecution validate the submission of this late evidence, which resulted in what was just shared with us here.
Right.
You had already made a decision?
Yes.
About late submissions?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
Nate, any input, Nate?
I'll just note that that your ruling stated that witnesses, the prosecution team could call witnesses at the hearing to provide any supporting information regarding the evidence that the prosecution team submitted that Bodine objected to as lacking sufficient authentication or reliability or relevance. Your ruling noted that the prosecution team could call those witnesses at the hearing to address that. The ruling did not allow the prosecution team to submit written declarations to support that evidence. I will just also note that we heard a number of arguments from the prosecution team as to why it would be consistent with the hearing procedure, the regulations, and the laws that apply to this hearing to allow these declarations. And I think while it is true that you do have the discretion to accept late evidence, the regulations are clear that you shall exclude it if it's prejudicial to a party. And that can only be modified upon a showing of severe hardship. I don't believe we've heard arguments regarding a severe hardship as to why that evidence could not have been submitted earlier, those witness declarations. And I will note that the hearing procedure is fairly clear in that in Section E, pre-hearing submittals, to avoid the introduction of surprise testimony and exhibits, and to minimize the need for oral argument and testimony at the hearing, this hearing procedure requires the parties to submit documentary evidence, witness information, and legal technical memoranda prior to the hearing. And those pre-hearing submittals were due in this instance back in August. So again, you have the discretion, and the board has the discretion to accept these. And I think what the prosecution team is in part arguing is that, well, we can call the witnesses and they can read these declarations into the record, and your ruling wouldn't prohibit that, but that will involve a substantial amount of time for the witnesses to read that testimony into the record if the prosecution chooses to introduce it in that form. The board can weigh that argument in structuring the hearing for efficiency and whether that's a factor that you want to heavily weigh. I do think what it comes down to ultimately is prejudice and whether there is prejudice, and does it impact the fairness of this hearing to allow these written declarations at this stage?
Yes.
Counselor, in fact, both sides have 5 hours to make their case, and they have the freedom to use that 5 hours as they see fit or necessary. So the prosecution could invite the respondents to enter their testimony into the record if that's how they so choose to use their time. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Sorry for the clarification, and that's if the decision of this board is to not allow it at all, they could still choose to. Is that my understanding, or is that the correct understanding
of
the matter?
That's correct. If the decision is to not allow these written declarations, that written testimony won't come into the record, but those witnesses, the prosecution team has indicated, are available to testify. They could essentially provide that testimony orally as part of their case.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking of the flow of the meeting in light of the tour today. And so I guess I'd like to offer the board an option to meet, take a brief recess, review this, and then come back and or just plunge into it.
Mr. Chair, if I might, on a process question through you to our advisory counselor, is the decision in front of you as the presiding officer, or is it in front of us as the five members of this board?
So, Board Member McKenzie, as the presiding officer, the chair can ultimately make the ruling and has the authority to make that ruling, but with input from board members as appropriate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's been a policy of mine that this isn't my board. I mean, my decision will be based on what my board members say, the majority of the board members. So I'd like to take a recess and review this with them.
Okay, so just to be clear, then the board will be discussing this in closed session. And the timing 15, for that.
15 minutes?
15 minutes. So let me ask, do you want to hold that closed session immediately now, or do you want to continue with the rest of the hearing introduction and then hold the closed session at the conclusion of that? Maybe it makes sense to have it now.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going back to the other back room.
So let's recess for closed session.
Question.
All right.
If this isn't.
two motions that are actually, I think, in front of the board. One deals with the issue that we're talking about right here, and the other one deals with the PowerPoint presentation that was submitted yesterday by the prosecution team. And Ms. Rubin mentioned that, and we haven't talked about it yet today.
So we're not intending to address motions that came in late last night at this stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, folks. Thank you for your patience. After consult with the board members and advisory, my ruling on the admissibility of the prosecution team's January 30th witness declarations is that the prosecution team's request is denied. The declarations will not be admitted. This is consistent with the hearing procedure regulations applicable to this hearing and my January 24, 2025 ruling that noted that the prosecution team would call witnesses at the hearing to provide any supporting testimony to address evidence submitted and Bodine's objections. The prosecution team may use its case in chief presentation time however it chooses, but will not be allowed additional time and are limited to 5 hours. This ruling does not address the pending motion to dismiss from Bodine that was received late last night, February 4th. Bodine may use its presentation time as it chooses and may raise objections as it deems necessary.
May I ask a clarifying question? To be clear, these documents were given to Bodine a week ago, and we would literally be having the witnesses, the declarants, come up and read the contents to the stand. To avoid wasting everyone's time, will it suffice to have the witnesses come forward and testify that the contents of the declaration is true and correct? As you can see, we are already behind time. And, you know, after the witnesses would do that, Bodine would have an opportunity to cross-examine them on the contents of their declaration, which, again, they've had for over a week, and then we would move to have them admitted to the record.
Counsel.
Does you might ask if Bodine has a response to that.
Does Bodine have a response to that?
Yeah, Chair. I think we would. I think that'd be acceptable to us if they wanted to come up during their case in chief and acknowledge the contents of their declaration. Then we could certainly cross-examine them on that in that moment. The problem that we would have is that, you know, in a situation like that, again, both sides have 5 hours. So now we've allowed these declarations functionally to become part of the record with virtually no time prejudice to the prosecution team. But now, you know, we're going to have to spend, 30 minutes, an hour, to go through the contents of the declarations that have now been submitted into the record. So if that's the ruling from the chair, then I think that we would need additional time in order to make that cross-examination. Otherwise, you know, we're the ones, the Bodine, that are suffering as a result of that for no time lost to the prosecution team.
Then I would be inclined to, counsel, just guide me on this, but I would be inclined to grant an additional 30 minutes.
Yeah, I think that would be acceptable.
Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Chair, may I say something? I'm already getting impatient with this tit for tat, and I think we could spend the rest of the day going back and forth on things that I find an annoyance at this point already, and we haven't even got started. I think you've made your rulings clear in the past, and I think we need to hold firm and move this forward. Just my opinion.
Well, what I'd like to do is set a precedence that the prosecution team has to submit their reports on time. It has to be reported on a timely basis, not by memory, but we expect better from our staff.
So just to be clear, Chair Bedoya, is the ruling after no objection from Bodine to allow the declarations to be admitted, and Bodine will be offered 30 minutes additional time to cross-examine?
Is it? As we spoke, the verbal testimony would authenticate these declarations.
Correct. The verbal testimony could authenticate the contents of the declarations, effectively admitting those declarations into evidence. And so provided the prosecution team does that, and Bodine is granted an additional 30 minutes, that's the ruling?
Correct.
Okay.
All right, where do we go from here? Who's next?
So if I may, Chair, and yes. I'm sensitive also not for making this a tit-for-tat thing. But,
absolutely.
But we do have an important objection to the slide deck that was submitted by the prosecution team yesterday. We submitted a motion last night to address that, and the objection goes to the same issues that we're talking about in the last 20 minutes. The
okay. question is, I think that that will not be admitted.
No. Thank you.
I believe your ruling noted that the respondent could raise those objections verbally during the course of the hearing. Is that okay? I just wanted to make sure I understood yes. the intent of what you were saying. Thank you.
Yeah, the chair and the board may hear objections from the parties as the hearing progresses, and that's a normal course of the hearing. And Bodine, if certain matters come up during the hearing and issues in the presentations of either side, the parties may object to those presentations and what they depict, and those objections can be addressed at that time.
Good. Yes.
Mr. Chair, through you to our advisory people, during the course of the hearing, if an objection is made, do the proceedings come to a halt at that time, and does the board advise the chair one more time as to how to proceed?
There's no set rule or formula for how to proceed on objections. Some may be ruled on in that moment, instantaneously. Others, the hearing can continue, and the objection may be addressed at a later time. Yeah.
Well, I will assume, Mr. Chair, that you as the presiding officer will rule as to how we move forward at that time.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I think now, continuing with the...
Now I'll discuss the order of this proceeding as outlined in the hearing procedure. One, parties' opening statements. Two, prosecution team's case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses. Three, respondent Bodine's cross-examination of prosecution witnesses. Four, respondent Bodine's case presentation and direct testimony from witnesses. Five, prosecution team cross-examination of Bodine witnesses. Six, prosecution team's rebuttal and Bodine rebuttal as necessary. Seven, party's closing arguments. Eight, public comments, if any, following conclusion of the party's cases. Any members of the public wishing to give non-evidentiary policy statements will have 5 minutes to do so. This will most likely occur on Friday the 7th. Nine, board deliberation and consideration. The board may meet in closed session to deliberate on this matter. Do the parties have any questions about this general order of proceedings?
For respondent, Chair, no, we do not.
No, we do not. Thank you.
Thank you. As stated in the public notice and hearing procedure, each party will be allowed a total of 300 minutes. Cross-examination of another party will count towards your allotted time. Board members or members of the advisory team may ask questions at any time. The timer will stop for procedural discussions, questions from the board members or the advisory team, and other causes such as technical issues. The timer will show time left to each party. Parties may request a time update at any time. I may modify these procedures and time allocations as needed upon request and for good cause. Each of the elements may be exercised at your discretion and subject to your time limit. Each party has visual aids that they will utilize during the presentation of their cases in chief. Each party has the control of their own presentations and can present their case in whatever manner they choose. Each witness that the parties intend to call will be required to take an oath prior to giving testimony. We will not have all witnesses here today, so witnesses shall take an oath that they swear to tell the truth that they, as they are called to testify. We have a court reporter transcribing these proceedings. Please clearly state your name, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath before testifying. This hearing is being conducted in person and via video conference. The same rules that apply in this hearing room apply to those participating remotely. Any other questions from board members, the parties, or matters the advisory team would like to address before we begin?
I do have a question about what you just said. Are you not going to administer, are you going to administer the oath, have the oath administered separately for each witness, or are we not going to have it administered as a group and then do it again for people who aren't here?
We'll do it again for people who aren't here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, just to be clear, did I understand you correctly that you gave each party an additional half hour so they each have 330 minutes? As opposed to what was originally written at 300?
I believe it was just the respondent.
So the respondent has 330 minutes
Correct.
Total. Okay, thank you.
Just one question on that point about witness testimony. So are we preparing to, I mean, now would be the time then to have those witnesses that are present here today to swear to tell the truth?
Okay. Witnesses, raise your right hand and do you swear to tell the truth on all matters today?
Yes.
Thank you. The parties can now make a brief opening statement, each no more than 10 minutes before we reconvene at the quarry site. Parties may elect to continue their opening statements tomorrow when we reconvene in the hearing room. But I will impose a time limit on opening statements today. We will begin with opening statements from the prosecution team, followed by Respondent Bodine.
Question regarding slides. I think we had intended to be able to plug our laptops in here. Maybe what I'm hearing from staff is that that's not going to broadcast to the Zoom meeting if I just plug in here and use HDMI to put it up on the screen. So
no, the intention was for the parties to have Zoom logins and share screen on Zoom.
Okay. I am not presently logged into Zoom, so can I request a 5-minute recess to get the tech set up?
Okay.
Thank you.
Would we continue with the respondents' opening statements?
Given that it might create some noise and sort of activity to get logged onto Zoom, I would hate for that to distract from
All right.
Being able to pay attention to the presentation. We'll have... So I think, I mean, it would probably be best if everybody just sat here for 5 minutes so that we can resume as quickly as possible.
We'll do that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a clarifying question to Bodine. Are you all logged on to the Zoom? You have access to that? Okay, it's just me. Apologies.
Okay, we're ready to go?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, members of the board, Board Chair Bedoya. My name is Catherine Haw, and I'm an attorney with the State Water Resources Office of Enforcement. Along with my colleagues, Dan Kippen and Naomi Rubin, we represent the North Coast Water Board's prosecution team, comprised primarily of staff from your region and led by Assistant Executive Officer Claudia Villacorta. Our team is large, so I won't introduce everyone by name today, but as we present to you over the coming days, staff will introduce themselves when they come up to speak. No, it is. Is that better? Thank you for your time and attention to this matter over the coming days. At its basic level, this case involves a massive discharge of sediment-laden stormwater from an active quarry operated by Bodine Co. Inc. into a sediment-impaired watershed, providing important salmon habitat, including for endangered species. As a point of background, this complaint is primarily based on the allegation that Bodine did not comply with the industrial general permit, thereby resulting in 10.5 million gallons of sediment-laden discharge into Porter Creek. The discharge originated from Marquess Quarry, a site enrolled in the permit. This permit requires Bodine to implement and maintain certain best management practices, or BMPs, and importantly prohibits discharges from the site unless they are in compliance with the permit. Later today, when we visit the quarry, you are going to see a very different operation than what Regional Water Board staff encountered when they first visited this site during the period of alleged violations in 2018. The prosecution team acknowledges that the site has significantly improved its implementation of the permit over the last 6 years. These improvements came after significant compliance assistance efforts and progressive enforcement, ultimately resulting in the proceeding before you today. When we visit the quarry this afternoon, you will see a site with paved roads, 3 active treatment systems, updated mining practices, and substantially more BMPs deployed than what the photos in the prosecution team's case in chief will show. Today, when we view Porter Creek, we hope to find that the discharge from the quarry is clear. If we do, it will be a testament to the effectiveness of staff's efforts, engaging in compliance assistance and progressive enforcement. When you see the creek today, you will recognize your region's distinctive watershed and its capacity to provide habitat for one of the state's most treasured endangered species, the coho salmon. This is not what regional board staff saw when they first visited the creek in 2018 and 2019, the wet weather period that underlies violation one. Instead, the violations at issue here are based on water board staff's documentation of a stream polluted with sediment. The impacts to the creek from the quarry were visually apparent and obvious over the period of alleged misconduct in the complaint. Unsurprisingly, based on the conditions I just showed you in Porter Creek when Water Board staff first visited the site, during the period of alleged violations, BMPs were nearly non-existent or totally overwhelmed at Marquess Quarry. Remember, it is not conditions similar to what we hope you observe today that necessitated the enforcement action before you now. When Water Board staff first arrived on site, conditions like the ones on the screen were present. Straw wattles were overwhelmed, and the total number of BMPs present at the site were not enough to manage the quarry's expansive industrial operation. Some inspection reports, which will be detailed by our staff later, only document the presence of a single straw wattle over a 10-acre area. In contrast, today you will see improved conditions. Improve source control and likely see adequately installed and maintained minimum BMPs like straw wattles utilized throughout the entire site. Conditions like the one on the slide prior persisted well into the 2019 wet weather season and continued through 2023. Over the course of 20 inspections, regional board staff noted BMP deficiencies at the quarry every single time they were on site. Again, today, when we arrive on site, we hope the conditions do not resemble these photos. Bodine will be able to show you improvements it has made, including installation of significant structural BMPs, including, for example, the eroded road shown in the left photo on the screen now is partially paved, and the installation of expensive active treatment BMPs. These BMPs that you will see are not extraordinary. They are merely what is required to comply with the permit. With that background, I want to provide you with a summary of the alleged violations. The complaint alleges 7 total violations. Ultimately, the prosecution team has adjusted the total liability we are asking to be imposed by this board to be based solely on the amount generated for violation 1. We will detail this decision-making process later and throughout our presentation, but for now, I will provide a summary. Violation 1 proposes that you impose an administrative civil liability for Bodine's discharge of over 10.5 million gallons of sediment-laden stormwater during the time period during which Bodine most seriously failed to comply with the permit's BMP requirements. Specifically, Bodine failed to adequately implement and maintain various categories of minimum and advanced BMPs on site, and as such, was in violation of the permit. The permit says at Section 3A that all discharges of stormwater to waters of the United States are prohibited except as specifically authorized by this general permit or another NPDES permit. The discharge alleged in violation 1 is among the biggest volume ever brought before this board, and as such, we are proposing a large liability, over $8.5 million. Violations 2 through 5 are non-discharge violations relating to the lack of certain required BMPs at the site. We won't spend as much of our time focusing on these BMP failures, especially those that occur outside the time period of violation 1, because the prosecution team is not asking that the board impose any liability for violations 2 through 5. But we will introduce ample evidence to support the imposition of additional liability in light of these violations. Finally, violations 6 and 7 are also non-discharge violations, and they relate to sampling information that Bodine failed to collect and report to the water boards. Again, we aren't asking the board to impose a liability for these violations, so while there's evidence in the record to support the imposition of liability based on them, we will not spend much time discussing them this morning or as part of our presentation tomorrow. As you tour the site today, keep in mind the important role that the Regional Water Board's enforcement action has played in motivating Bodine to correct its conditions at its facility. Bodine knew or should have known that its BMPs weren't functioning properly as required by the permit before Regional Board even arrived on site in 2018 and 2019. Yet, Bodine's operations impacted Porter Creek for too long, and improvements at the facility were too slow. The prosecution team needed to escalate this matter to the proceeding before you today to ensure that Bodine got the message. Water Board's requirements must be complied with. Protecting water quality doesn't happen on the discharger's schedule. It happens right away, as soon as an issue is identified. Following through with the imposition of a significant liability, as recommended by the prosecution team, is critical to tell Bodine and the regulated community, you cannot pollute the North Coast region's water bodies, especially when it threatens an endangered species. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I just ask one question?
Of course.
Thank you, Catherine. Good job. The 10 million gallon tally, what was the source of that number? Where did it come from?
That number is based on a reported volume by Bodine to the water boards.
So that number was generated by the respondent?
Correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Your turn.
Thank you, Chair. Sean Hungerford, I'm representing Bodine in this case. I'm here with Cassandra Goltz next to me.
May I ask that the prosecution team stop sharing on Zoom, please? Thank you.
Cassandra. While we're getting the slide up, just to address the question that came up a moment ago. The 10.5 million gallons is a number that did come from Bodine. but it didn't wasn't a, an estimate of sediment discharges, simply an estimate of stormwater runoff. Obviously, that's something that we'll be covering both sides in the you know proceeding during our cases in chief. Okay, so again, I'm Sean Hungerford. I'm here representing Bodine. We're pleased to be here, and we're looking forward to this hearing. It's been a long time in coming. We'll offer just a few brief opening remarks. First, a word about Bodine and the Marquess Quarry. Bodine is a local company that produces construction materials. It was started by Dean Soylent and Belinda Soylent. And Belinda's nickname is Bo, and that's where the name of the company comes from. It's an amalgamation of their names. Dean is here in the audience, and Bo will be joining us later when we get to the case in chief, and others from Bodine will be showing up as well. The company began in 1988, and over the last few decades, it's grown to include a little over 50 employees, operating out of four locations in Santa Rosa, the Marquess Quarry being one of them. It's a local company, and we're very proud to represent them. So this hearing concerns one of Bodine's facilities, the Marquess Quarry. Now, the quarry, as you'll see this afternoon, is a surface mining operation. And we're going to assume over the course of this hearing that surface mining operations are not something that's familiar to the board or familiar to the advisory team. So we're going to do our best to educate people. And if there's questions along the way, we'd be pleased to answer them, and we'll do our best. It's enough to know for the moment that a surface mining operation is a very unique type of business. It's also a very unique type of industrial facility. It's the only business of its type that uses the earth itself as inventory. Rock is brought up from the ground. It's crushed and sorted into different types and gradations. It's made available for customers to come pick up. And some of these products are used to make asphalt. Some are used to make cement. Some are used for road base. And it's the sort of material that you know we as a society use to make roads, bridges, schools, homes, and hospitals. And because the Marquess Quarry has been in operation since 1910, there's a pretty good chance that this building and the parking lot that surrounds us and the roads that we used to get in on were probably made from material from the Marquess Quarry. It's also important to understand that a surface mining operation is a very dynamic thing. It's a continuously evolving environment. The landform itself is always changing, and operations are always changing to adapt to changing geologic conditions and adapt to changing customer demands. There's really no other industrial activity that's quite like it. And among the spectrum of surface mining operations, the Marquess Quarry itself is also very unique. And I can say, having done this for a few years, representing mines and quarries, that the Marquess Quarry is one of the most impressive, well-run, and responsibly operated quarries in the state of California. And I think you'll get a sense for that when you visit this afternoon. I'll point out a few specific reasons for that. One, this is the first quarry in the nation to install a solar array that meets 100% of the quarry's electrical needs. And this has served to reduce the quarry's carbon emissions footprint by about 1,000 metric tons per year. Second, the Marquess Quarry was also the first in the nation to use a unique type of water recycling system known as a filter press that allows the quarry to recycle water at a very, very high rate of efficiency. And this system avoids the need for wastewater ponds, which is protective of water quality. Thirdly, and maybe most importantly for our purposes today, this is the first quarry that we're aware of in the state of California that uses a water treatment system of the type that you'll be seeing today. These systems are not typical. They are state-of-the-art technology, and they represent a remarkable investment, both in technology that's virtually unprecedented in the industry in California. And these are the types of investments and advancements that really typify Bodine as a company. It's in the company's DNA to do those things. You'll get a sense of that for the next few days. So with the help of these water treatment systems and other improvements, the Marquess Quarry discharges stormwater that tends to be cleaner than background concentrations in the watershed and is below any action level in the industrial general permit. This shows the Marquess Quarry is on the cutting edge of stormwater control and management, and the company is very proud of these achievements. So brings us to the question, why are we here? So the prosecution team is going to point to the fact that the Marquess Quarry has, at times, discharged turbid water. And they will almost certainly present, as they've already have, many, many photographs showing that. Most of these images you'll find will be quite dated, from 2018-19, more than 5 years ago. We anticipated this coming into the hearing that the prosecution's case would be largely based on photographs that will be shown through their presentation in what can only be described as a tabloid-esque way. And what we've seen so far hasn't disappointed. And our position on this is very, very clear. Where turbid discharges have occurred, and the evidence shows that the basin plan's turbidity standard was exceeded as a result of that, as a result of Bodine's discharges, we'll own that. But we aren't talking about very many days. The prosecution team itself alleges only 13 days of basin plan exceedances spread out over a five-year period. We think the evidence doesn't support those days. The prosecution's dominant claim, however, and the one that requires the most careful attention and scrutiny from this board, is that the Marquess Quarry failed to implement best management practices in the manner required by the permit. And you will hear, in all likelihood, claims and testimony that from the prosecution team that the BMPs were absent or inadequate. And they'll have photographs of site conditions that are taken out of context. The photographs will have captions expressing staff's subjective opinion that there are no BMPs or they were inadequate. The fundamental flaw in the prosecution team's approach is that the legal standard governing best management practices do not depend on regional board staff's subjective opinion on whether they're adequate or not. That approach is contrary to law. Instead, the permit has a more objective standard. In the words of the permit, BMPs must, quote, meet best industry practices, considering technological availability and economic practicability and achievability. And to this point, to this relevant point, the record will show that Bodine, at all times, implemented best management practices that were consistent with or exceeded best industry practices in this industry. You'll see that in the record, and you hear that from experts that have decades of experience in the industry. And the prosecution team, for its, you know, all of its photographs, has not offered a single shred of evidence on this point. Their record is completely absent of any evidence of best industry practices that's been advanced by the prosecution team in this case. The record also will show that Bodine promptly took action, all the actions set forth in the permit, in those moments when stormwater quality declined. They studied the problem, they explored different technologies, they submitted the reports required by the Water Board and required by the permit. And in short, Bodine engaged in precisely the sort of iterative process that's required by the permit. Those actions, rather than being attacked as they are here in this proceeding, should be regarded as a model for stormwater compliance throughout the state. So as we go through the next few days, and we ask that this board look fairly at the law and at the evidence. And we ask that you not fall for the tabloid photographs, that you pay close and careful attention to the claims that are made and that the evidence being put before you. And we have no doubt that through that process, you'll reach a fair result. Thank you.
I have a question.
Yes.
Can you tell me what dates those high-tech filters were installed and all those mitigation?
Good question, Chair.
Facilities?
There are two sets of treatment systems installed. The first was installed in December of 2019. And the second was installed a month later in January 2020. I would point out that those installations came about 2 years before the first iteration of the ACL complaint that was issued in this case. And about 5 years before the most recent one. So they've been in place for some time.
Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chair, question for our counsel, Nate. It was brought up two terms, best industry practices versus best management practices. I'm assuming that was an accurate testimony that word is there. Both can be argued to be vague. I need some help on, you know, how they compare. Or are they incongruent?
Ooh, good morning. So Board Member Giusti, I believe that specific point will be discussed in detail when we get into the parties' cases, and so I think I would defer until we hear from the parties.
Thank you. What time are we scheduled to prep for the tour?
We are scheduled to begin the tour on site at the quarry at 1 p.m. It takes about a half hour to get there from the office, so we have very limited time to try to eat some lunch and get on the road by 12:30.
All right. Well, then let's take our lunch break and proceed from there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Meeting's not resuming today. Excuse me, Mr. Chair, I think we want to be clear for the recording that this meeting is not planned to resume here in the boardroom until tomorrow morning, so that the today's meeting will conclude after the tour and will resume tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.
Thank you, Madam Executive Officer.
You are welcome, Honorable Chair.
Hello.
All right.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for your patience while we got recording up and running. I'm Valerie Quinto, Executive Officer and Advisory Team Member. I just want to note that the time we took to set up audio and video is essential to this. This site tour is part of a hearing, and so it's important for the record that we're recording it. This site visit is part of a hearing on administrative civil liability complaint R1-2021-0047A issued to Bodine Company Incorporated, the operator of the Mark West Quarry. The parties to that proceeding are Bodine Company Incorporated and the North Coast Water Board prosecution team. To ensure that the hearing is fair, the parties are not allowed to engage in ex parte communications with members of the board or staff that advise the board, also known as the advisory team. I also want to note that while this is a public tour, this is private property, and the owner of this property has asked that nobody take photos while we're here. We are collecting video to record what's transpiring in the hearing, but we're asking that folks not pull out cell phones and take photos of the site. And with that, I think I'm handing it over to Bodine to begin their presentation of this location.
So again, I'm Sean Hungerford, for the record, counsel for Bodine. This is the first of a number of locations. Not all locations we anticipated visiting will be visited because of the weather and the condition of the roads. Where we are now is known as the Mark West Quarry Scale House. This is where aggregate products, meaning various grades and sizes of rock, are made available to visiting customer trucks. Trucks will enter from Porter Creek Road, customer trucks, travel up the driveway, are filled by loaders in this area that you can see right here. Aggregate in the back of the trucks will loop around, come around to the scales where they'll be weighed and ticketed before departing. And the quarry's rock products are used by a wide variety of local construction projects such as highways, bridges, homes, and hospitals, just to name a few. Thanks.
Good afternoon, Catherine Ha, counsel for the prosecution team. Is it on? It says it's on. Can you not hear me? Just restate that again for the record. Catherine Ha, counsel for the prosecution team. Are we good? Because of the industrial activity that Bodine conducts here, it's required to enroll in the Industrial General Permit. The Industrial General Permit is a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or shortened to NPDES, permit that the State Water Board issues. The quarry has been regulated by the Industrial General Permit for more than 30 years. Porter Creek, the receiving water for the majority of the quarry's stormwater discharge, is just on the other side of the road you turned off to enter the site. Roughly 120 acres. The complaint is primarily focused on the portion of the site known as Tributary Area C, which is approximately 13 acres of industrial drainage area. Tributary Area C extends to the top of the quarry, which we will visit in a moment, I think. No top of the quarry today. And eventually a portion of the rainwater that falls on Tributary Area C makes its way to Porter Creek, as you will see later in this visit.
The plan from this point to the end. Please make no sense.
sense to go out of order and do that with more capital results. So, that makes sense to you?
Yeah, so can we just clarify for the record, are we visiting all the locations that are on the script? What is not
being? Anything that's weather permitting is off.
All the weather permitting is off.
So we can't, the third bench is the highest we can go, and everything above that is not safe.
Okay, so the proposal is, instead of getting in vehicles and going to the third bench and then coming back here, just do everything that's here on foot and then view the third bench last. Is prosecution comfortable with that?
I'm fine with changing the order of it. So we're going to skip the quarry viewing area on the east side.
Yes.
And the top and back side of the quarry.
That's right.
Top and back side. Okay. I'm fine with changing the order of it. I just wanted to understand what was the extent of the tour.
Okay. So I'm going to direct everyone at this point. We're going to walk over.
Yes. Please do.
Anthony, do you want to kind of all right, everyone, we're going to follow Mr. Boyle over to the next viewing location. So if everyone would just move this way. All right, so we're now at the location known as the filter press area. So the filter press material, sometimes it'll be called cake material during this proceeding. And the cake is a... says it is. Yeah, the mic's on. It's not a loudspeaker. I guess you come closer. Yeah, bring it in. Fireside chat. So the cake material is a clay-like sediment that's produced by the rock processing operation. So across from us, just to walk you through the process, is Bodine's wash plant, this area right over here. And this is where some of the rock, not all of it, some of it that's mined from the quarry, is taken and washed to meet certain specifications of some state and government agencies. The wash water generated by the washing process is captured at a sump at a low point in the wash plant. It's from there, it's pumped over to the clarifier, the big open tank that you see over here. The clarifier collects the silts and sediments from the wash water, which settle at the bottom. Clean water is then pumped to the next tank. Both of these are 100,000-gallon tanks. The clean water is then recycled for reuse as part of the wash plant. The silts that collect at the bottom of the clarifier are pumped through a unique filter press system, the type described earlier in the hearing this morning. In this building, this part of this pump system, the silts are... and solids are collected, and the water is squeezed out under immense pressure. The water is recycled for use in the wash plant. The solids that have been removed in moisture drop over here in this covered storage area. And these solids, known as cakes, are generally naturally sediments and silts. Occasionally, the cake material is sold to wineries and used for pond liners. More often, at the Marquis Quarry, it's brought up to the top of the hillside where it's used for revegetation purposes because it makes a good topsoil medium.
Currently, stormwater flowing along this path enters one of two outfalls at this location at the end of the valley gutter adjacent to the wall. One pipe discharges into the intake tanks for the treatment system, and the other bypasses and discharges directly down the hill to Culvert and Porter Creek. The third pipe that we can see here is an overflow from the stormwater capture and reuse system behind us. Prior to the installation and operation of the treatment system in December 2019, this water was routed through three settling structures which remain today as a series of intake faults for the treatment system which were intended to allow settling. Prior to the installation of the treatment system, stormwater entered these tanks for various times to allow for sediment to settle out of the water before discharging down the hill and into Porter Creek via Culvert. The whole road, actually around the turn there, was paved in October 2019.
All right, everyone.
That'd be amazing. Thank you.
So, this is known as discharge point SP3. Down here. This is the terminal point for stormwater generated in drainage area C, which includes approximately 13.4 acres and extends to the top of the hillside, passes through the third bench and pond 3, and from there via rock-lined ditch to this point. Currently, the SP3 discharge point is accompanied by an advanced treatment system with the ability to treat 1,000 gallons per minute of stormwater. The system became operational in December of 2019. Stormwater discharge from SP3 is released into an armored hillside, then passes down the hill to a culvert at the edge of Porter Creek Road.
This location is the bottom of Tributary Area C. The active treatment system here that treats runoff from Tributary Area C became operational in December 2019. The active treatment system functions by pushing water through a series of sand filters, augmented by adding flocculant to stormwater, to cause very fine sediment to clump together in chunks, which makes it heavy enough to settle out and be filtered out of the stormwater. The treatment system uses an aluminum-based chemical flocculant. The treatment system is designed to treat 1,000 gallons per minute. Prior to December 2019, there were three settling tanks provided to settle sediment out of the stormwater prior to discharge. Two of these settling tanks have been retained and can be seen here. Yeah. Just to repeat for the record, the board member's question, Board Member McKenzie just asked where those settling tanks are. The ones that have been retained, and I believe they're these up here, right? Oh, no, they're down here. They're down here, and folks, it's okay for folks to come over and take a look at them as part of this treatment system. I'll continue with the script now. They currently are used as the intake faults from which stormwater is pumped into the treatment system. The multiple discharge pipes you can see on this end below the treatment system here include the small gray PVC pipe, which discharges treated stormwater from the treatment system, and the larger corrugated plastic pipe, which is the bypass discharge point for if and when the capacity of the treatment system is exceeded. Yeah, and I think at this point we would just invite folks to come over and make sure you get the full view.
Where are these pipes?
So this one, you can see the retained, the retained tanks that remain a part of the system, these two here. And the pipes are really visible in the treatment system, which you can see if you walk a little further down here.
Thank you.
So at this point, we're going to have to load up.
All right.
So everyone, all the board members have a chance to shower. Does everyone have a chance to look at what they want to do?
I believe so.
Okay.
And I just was confirming with the chair about the question. We can see if we have a question.
Catherine or Sean?
Yeah.
This board member has a question.
Oh, thank you.
Where do the pipes go that discharge into the creek? Where are they? Are they out of sight, presumably?
So the pipes that leave the treatment system will discharge just right below the end of the concrete wall.
Okay.
You don't have a good view of it from right here. And then from there, it'll go down, as I said, an armored kind of rock and hillside, then it'll cascade down to Porter Creek Road, and then there's another culvert down there.
Right.
Okay. And they are visible if you walk further down this way along this wall. It's a little slippery down there. Dean is pointing, so you can see him if you walk down there, those couple of pipes we referenced, but Sean's description of the pathway is otherwise accurate.
I will walk down there. Thank you very much.
Oh, I have a question before we leave, and I don't know. I got so many lawyers around me, I don't know who to ask.
Just stay there then. So, Greg Giusti, board member. So yesterday we had a real slobber knocker of a storm around here, right? So that water coming down this road, was it captured by these berms and down this road down here?
Yes.
And then it was channeled back into these settling ponds somehow?
If I may.
Sure.
Okay. The water that came down this road, or that came down the rock lane ditch that you see just adjacent to the road, would have come down, entered into these tanks, and gone into the treatment system.
So there's a way to collect that water from some mechanism at the bottom of this hill to redirect that water back into some capture system before it's discharged to the creek.
Everything here in this area that you can see, the road, the ditch, the hillside, reports to this treatment system. And then from there, it goes down, it discharges right there, then goes down the hillside and into a roadside ditch.
Okay. And sorry, I just want to clarify, and I'll try not to do too much tit for tatting, but that the treatment system does have a capacity, and sometimes, including yesterday, the capacity for the treatment system is exceeded and a bypass event occurs, which means that the stormwater coming off of the site discharges directly to Porter Creek without any treatment. So there are limitations to the system.
Every facility has those limitations. I understand that.
So forgive me, but how old is this system? When was it operational, not just beginning of construction?
The tanks that are the first two or three sections right here have been in operation as long as anyone can remember. We'll hear more about that tomorrow. The treatment system itself was installed and was operational in December of 2019.
And how long was the planning process for the latter half of that, the system itself?
The contract for the treatment system was entered into in June 2019, so about 5 months before the treatment system was installed.
Just a clarification. So it looked like you wanted to respond to the comment about the bypass during heavy storm events and precipitation. And I just wanted to offer that opportunity to respond.
I appreciate that. Yeah, my comment would be is that the statement that was made is it would go down into the culvert without any treatment at all, which isn't true because in the record will show this. At all points in time, at least there have been these tanks in place and then, of course, augmented by the treatment system. So at no point in time was uncontrolled drainage coming down out of the quarry and going out into the creek. That was my clarification. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, then the next stop is to make our way up to the third bench, but that's not going to happen on foot. So when you go back to the vehicles, we'll load up as much as we can consolidate people and vehicles, and we'll caravan our way up there because it's not really that walkable.
For clarification, are we taking our own vehicles or are we loading into Bodine vehicles?
I believe we're loading into Bodine vehicles.
Yeah, we'll try and load up in as many Bodine vehicles as possible. And then maybe some of our council vehicle if we got anybody with a free seat. We'll kind of get over there. We'll kind of get everybody arranged appropriately and see where we're at.
Thank you. I just didn't want people going for their own cars if they weren't supposed to.
Good? Okay. All right, everyone. This is known as the third bench area. So you'll hear this a lot over the course of the next couple of days. This area includes a shop, a 100,000-gallon water storage tank over there, and there's a 12,000-gallon water storage tank immediately below where everyone's standing right here. This area also has pond three, which is this pond right here, which is an intermediate pond along the stormwater flow path from the top of the quarry to the discharge point farther below at SP3, where we were a moment ago. The underground and above ground water tanks give Bodine the flexibility to draw stormwater from pond three to be beneficially reused in its processing operations. And I'm going to finish the rest of it once we actually start working over there.
Oh, yeah, okay. So this pond was recently deepened. Treatment system three was made operational in December 2019 to treat stormwater that flows through this area. Prior to treatment system three being operational in December 2019, stormwater would pass through this area and flow into Porter Creek. Of note, the third bench surface area was paved in October 2019, and the underground water storage tank system here was installed in July of 2020.
So we're now going to just take a very short walk over here.
Do you want to give people the opportunity to take a look here?
Absolutely. You want to take a look over the K-rail? By all means, but be careful, please.
question for you. Maybe not for you, someone.
Question?
I have a
question.
So this water that we're seeing coming out of the hill, is that being collected, or is that water that's coming naturally out of the hill through a spring, an underground spring system?
I'll give you what I think is the answer.
Well, you can ask somebody else.
Well, we're trying to the majority of this is stormwater.
I know, but is it coming through the rock? Is it passing through? Is it groundwater that's coming out? Or is it being collected and coming off the road? Or these springs?
That surface water that's been collected at the top of the road is coming down the hill and coming in this pond. That, I think I'm assuming, is surface water as well rather than spring.
Yeah, so the pipe you guys see on the left is water coming down from the seventh bench and below that makes its way to here, to this location. And then the one on the right is actually a subdrain that we put in 20 years ago that's actually coming from underneath, that's underneath this fill that you guys see where the solar panels are on. So it's actually a subdrain underground that's lined with fabric, and then it's got three-quarter drain rocks collecting the water. So it's infiltrating through the fill and coming out the pipe. And so the water coming out of the pipe is sideboard ditches or something along the road? The one on the left is yes. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. When folks are ready, we'll meander.
Everyone hear me?
Yep.
All right, so this will be a short one. Okay. Here are a number of caves that are used primarily for storing materials and supplies. Stormwater from Pond 3 passes through a culvert under this road and emerges into a rock lane ditch, you can see to the south. And that ditch leads to the discharge point SP3. All right, so that concludes this area, unless there are questions. Okay.
And maybe I'll just clarify for the record, did we already say we're not going up any further up the quarry because of weather constraints?
That's right.
If the quarry was operating normally, would there be quarrying operations going on over there on the hillside?
I'm going to answer if the quarry were normally operating, yes, there would be trucks going on the hillside, or pouring actually occurring on the hillside. Now, during periods of wet weather, I understand that they'll curtail their operations. But in large, by and large, 24 hours a day, 365 days per year. Actually, probably not 24 hours a day. All right, I misspoke. But the quarry is open, at all points in time of the year. But it will close occasionally if storms are really, really bad.
Such as yesterday afternoon.
There were no. We were not doing any work outside of the first and third bench doing stormwater management yesterday. Nothing was going on. No equipment. Nothing was being was moving around.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other questions? What's this tank here? This tank here is what's that for?
This is a 12,000 gallon underground storage tank, and it's used. Go back to the script, but it's used for a number of things. One is they'll pull water from Pond 3. And they'll put it into the tank, and then it can be cycled back into the system through the freshwater tank and down to the wash plant for reuse. Also, and Anthony will correct me, occasionally they'll use that if they need extra water during the summertime when it's really, really dry. They'll have water tanks come up and do a dump into this tank, and then that'll be pushed into the system in that fashion.
That is correct.
I need a microphone.
So I may have missed it, but this large tank behind us, is that just a freshwater tank for human consumption, or is it a clarifier, or this big, it's like a digester?
I believe it's a freshwater tank that's used as part of the process water circuit here at the quarry. It's not for human consumption.
It's not potable.
I don't know if you get sick, yeah. But it's not intended for that.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Okay. So with that, we're going to load back up in the vehicles. We're going to go down to the SP1 location. It's the next location. And we're...
Yeah.
Sean Hungerford, for the record, it's necessary at this point. But below us is discharge point SP1, and this is the terminus of stormwater that is generated in drainage area B, which is approximately 17.2 acres. Stormwater from drainage area B enters pond 1, which is located on the other side of the advanced treatment system. Water from pond 1 enters the advanced treatment system, where sediment is removed by the treatment process. This system treats 2,000 gallons per minute and became operational in January of 2020. The resulting clean water is discharged through SP1, which is below us, into a natural drainage. Water in that drainage cascades down the hillside, passes through a culvert underneath the driveway, then passes through another culvert under Porter Creek.
Catherine Haw for the prosecution team. The complaint does not allege any violation for failure to utilize active treatment BMPs. Behind the treatment system is Pond 1. As recently as the spring of 2023, Water Board staff observed that Pond 1 was smaller compared to what you can see today.
So, can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
What's the filtration material that are in these advanced containers behind us?
I'm going to ask Anthony to answer that behind you.
So it's a combination of like a three-quarter drain rock aggregate, and then from about this point up, it's like a crushed glass media.
Okay. And... does it have to be renewed every year or every 5 years? Or what's the life of the substrate?
So the way that we monitor it is we take samples out of each pod yearly, and then we have to send it and look at it underneath a microscope. And then is what they're looking for is, you know, broken glass has multiple fractured edges, lots of points. They wait to see until the small particles are getting rounded. And then once they start getting rounded to a certain percentage, then we start... replacing the media.
Thank you very much.
Other questions for this location?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Very good. Are we going now to the bottom of driveway and roadside locations, yeah, where we need to reduce the group?
So
all that's left.
How many trucks can we fit down there?
Right now, should I talk on this?
No.
It's just,
yeah. So right now, there's the county's got red, muddy stockpiles all along our walking path, and there's a huge slide right across the street that's blocking half of Porter Creek. So right now, you actually got to walk down Porter Creek to get to it. That's blocked with the county mud material that they've been cleaning sides with.
Sorry, but you're referring to Porter Creek Road, not the
Porter Creek Road. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah,
Porter Creek Road.
And on that note, can I just make a slight clarification for the record? You said on the script that it passes through another culvert under Porter Creek. You left out the word road, I think, unintentionally, but I just wanted to clarify that.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, my mistake. Under Porter Creek Road.
So... I think so. If we go down to the bottom of the driveway, what would we be doing?
Well, you could see that was one of the locations.
That was a location.
Location. So the bottom of the driveway, you could see where water from this drainage pathway kind of goes down, hits a culvert on the upstream side of the driveway, and goes out into a little tank, and then goes again into another culvert. So you could view that, and at that point. It sounds like there'd be some difficulty going to the overlook to the culvert, but
I drove that way in, and they were working heavily just right to the left there. Well,
if we go down there, maybe we can address that. Get down there.
But should we, at this point, reduce the number of vehicles that we're taking down to the bottom of the driveway? Do we need to do that?
I think it'd probably be helpful because there's not a lot of parking down there. So,
I mean, with no truck, Sean, we could probably pull, I can pull all the way down to the bottom of the driveway, and then they can line up on the side if you like. Might be the best.
Do you think we can get this convoy down there like that?
Well, the slide is right after the culvert.
No, it's before the culvert.
Right now we're just talking about going down to the bottom of the driveway and then deciding there if we're going to view the creek. But we're trying to figure out how many cars, whether we need to reduce the size of the group going down to the bottom of the driveway or whether we can fit all the vehicles.
If reducing is an option, that's probably the most realistic way to do it.
Okay. I mean, I think we already agreed to that. So the reduced group, we need AGP. We need all board members, at least one attorney from each party. Me, and then I think we only have one member of the public present, right, Harriet?
Wow.
So okay. if you'd like to join for that stop, you're welcome to be able to view that. And then, you know, anyone else Bodine needs to have there. But I think that's the group. So we'll have to shuffle some cars to get there. So do I need to repeat who that was? Or did everyone? Board members, one attorney from each party, including advisory, me, AGP, public. And that's who's going down to the tight area.
All right, everyone. So we're at the base of the driveway. You can see where water from SP1 travels down the hillside, enters into a culvert that passes below us, then releases into this tank structure below us right here. From there, water enters another culvert that passes underneath Porter Creek Road and releases to Porter Creek via the location referred to as West Culvert. A portion of this tank structure and another similar structure about halfway up the driveway also collect stormwater runoff from the driveway itself, which is pumped back up to Pond 1 for treatment prior to discharge through SP1 before discharging to Porter Creek.
Discharge is not part of Tributary Area C and is not considered as a part of Violation 1. Here we see a settling tank which receives approximately half of the runoff from the driveway. The pump system which recirculates that pond water back up, that collected water back up to Pond 1 was recently installed. The stormwater which drains to this location from the area we just viewed at Pond 1 and includes discharge from portions of the active mining face and a portion of the mining process area, which is then discharged into Pond 1 and currently treated through treatment systems 1 and 2. From the treatment systems, the discharge travels down a steep slope on the upper side of the quarry's driveway, crosses the driveway through a culvert, and passes through the tank on the driveway, from where it discharges under Porter Creek Road and to Porter Creek through West Culvert.
Perfect. All right. Again, Sean Hungerford from Bodine. We're looking down on the culvert, which passes stormwater discharge from SP3. So I'm going to go a little bit off script just so we can explain it.
Okay.
So everyone's seen the SP3 discharge point. It was the first treatment system. Stormwater from that discharge point comes down the culvert. Comes down the hillside, I think a little bit up there around the bend, enters into a roadside culvert on that side of Porter Road, and goes in a culvert that then pokes out into Porter Creek. And this is in a location probably about 50, 75 yards up. And I think that's about it.
Yes. At this location, you are standing approximately on top of what is referred to as West Culvert. West Culvert does not receive drainage from Tributary Area C. However, the stormwater which drains to this location from the area we just viewed at Pond 1 and includes discharge from portions of the active mining face and a portion of the mining process area, which is then discharged into Pond 1 and currently treated through treatment systems 1 and 2, which were installed in January of 2020. From the treatment system, the discharge travels down a steep slope on the upper side of the quarry's driveway, crosses under the driveway through a culvert, and passes through the tank on the driveway where it discharges under Porter Creek Road and into Porter Creek through West Culvert. This discharge is downstream from monitoring locations. This location is not safely accessible for waterboard staff. Therefore, the waterboard staff did not collect monitoring data associated with this discharge location, Western Culvert.
Okay. Okay. Questions?
Oh, sorry. You don't have anything else. No, I'm not quite done yet. From this location, you can observe. So looking up there, kind of where the yellow traffic sign is, warning of falling debris, which is appropriate. From this location, you can observe the flow path of water that is discharged from SP3 and Treatment System 3. That's sort of what Sean was alluding to a moment ago. This culvert receives the runoff from Tributary Area C, in addition to runoff from Porter Creek Road and the hillside and other areas. Looking at the creek from up near that yellow sign, you see the location that is referred to as culvert. This culvert runs under the roadway and is a county-maintained culvert. Water leaving SP3... Water leaving SP3 traverses down the hillside above, over there, enters into a roadside ditch, which then commingles with runoff from the hillside and road, entering the culvert under Porter Creek Road and discharging below to Porter Creek. This location is the subject of complaint violation 1, and all of the receiving water locations discussed by the prosecution team are associated with this discharge point in Porter Creek. The discharge from SP3, which flows down the hillside above the culvert, is what is referred to as discharge. This discharge from the culvert is referred to as culvert. The sampling point within Porter Creek, upstream of culvert, is referred to as upstream, so even further up from that yellow sign, and is used as a background monitoring point when assessing the basin plan turbidity objective. The location in the creek is immediately downstream of the discharge from the culvert and is referred to as mixed, and is one of two downstream locations used to assess turbidity impacts. The most downstream sampling location is referred to as downstream and is approximately 50 feet downstream of culvert. These downstream monitoring locations provide data for assessing turbidity increase. Monitoring was conducted in Porter Creek associated with this discharge point because this was where the discharge was observed and the outfall location is accessible. You will see photos of staff in the creek and taking samples of discharge in the creek. These photos are typically showing this area here. Again, referring to what is visible from the road there, usually a little bit more easily accessible than it is today.
Questions?
Yeah, nothing further from me.
Yes, sir.
Question about monitoring pot. Question about monitoring points. You indicated background data to the east of the discharge and then monitoring to the west of the discharge. And are there any further monitoring points further to the west, further downstream?
The furthest downstream monitoring location that the prosecution team introduces evidence for is what is referred to as downstream and is about 50 feet downstream from culvert. I cannot answer whether or not there's additional receiving water monitoring available through some other entity further downstream. I'm not sure.
But what we will be hearing about is what you just told us.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Is a member of the public allowed to ask a question? I don't think they
are. Okay. We did set up the hearing so that the public wouldn't have an opportunity to participate, but we could. I mean, you are the only person here, so if it's up to the
I don't object.
It's up to the parties.
No. I think it's fine.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to ask a little further clarification about the water that goes down the hillside in terms of the volume of water during storm events. Like, it's a rocked hillside, you said, that goes down, that feeds into the culvert on this side of the road and then goes under the culvert out into the creek.
Please state your name for the record.
I'm sorry. My name is Harriet Buckwalter.
Yes. The discharge point at SP3, there's kind of a rocked and kind of concreted apron that extends out below the discharge point. So the water comes out of the pipe. It, you know, doesn't hit in an uncontrolled manner. And then from there, it works its way down the hillside until it gets to the roadside ditch.
So it gets dispersed as it goes down the hillside, but is there any kind of measurement of how much water at a time comes out of that culvert?
Good question. I imagine that there is, but I don't know that there's anything in the record in respect to this particular claim that addresses that specific question.
I had a question just for clarification. From the culvert upstream monitoring point, the prosecution team introduced into the record to the downstream, what's that span?
Oh, yeah, do you have a sense?
From the culvert to the downstream end?
So what's the reach of the creek? What's the reach of the creek that the monitoring data addresses? How many feet of the creek?
How much upstream and how much downstream?
Yeah.
It's about 50 feet.
It's about 50 feet upstream and about 50 feet downstream. And I believe there's also some data 200 feet downstream, but I will need to confirm with Heaven more on that.
And maybe I'll just repeat what's in the script, which is the most downstream sampling location is referred to as downstream and is approximately 50 feet downstream of culvert.
What I'm getting at is what we're seeing here is representative in the creek of what would be up there, the creek conditions.
Background creek conditions?
Or downstream.
Yeah, background creek conditions. Are we looking, the board can't go up to that point where the data was collected. Are we, what we're seeing right here is essentially, in the party's opinion, what we'd be seeing up there in terms of the creek conditions.
Yeah, I think that's fair. That's fair. I mean, you guys are up at SP3. I think we had a moment where the system turned on. Otherwise, there wasn't water coming out. So I don't know that there's any discharges at this moment in time. So upstream background conditions probably look a lot like this.
Yeah, I agree for the purposes of today, but you are going to see photos from the prosecution team of further upstream where it is quite clear where the quarry's discharge looks different than what background levels in the creek does. You couldn't see that today anyway.
I think we did it.
Yeah.
That's the last tour stop, right?
That's it. Just in time. It's getting chilly.
Yep.
We have successfully conducted our tour and ready to head back up to the vehicles. Okay.
Very good.
Okay.
So, what's wrap up? Is this an official session of the board being adjourned?
Does the chair need to? Well, it's being continued to tomorrow morning, but does the chair need to
adjourn the meeting for today? Yeah, I think this is the end of the meeting.
Okay, am I on camera?
Yep.
Do I need a microphone?
Yeah.
Probably.
My name is Hector Bedoya, chair of the board, and this meeting is hereby adjourned. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.